Hey everybody, that was Knuckle Bear, Medicine for the People, Seven Feathers, Project Earth, Ohm, OHM, Dome, DOME, just what we were talking about for the last hour. Radical change and using the right materials. Yeah, calcium and silica, organic materials to create spherical living. And you can have indoor gardens and outdoor gardens. And you can build them so that when you're going over them, it looks like you're in a starship. Literally, you've got pods going in a ring with glass connectors. Where you've got all this light coming in, and you've got trees growing in there, and vegetable gardens and flower gardens, and then you've got in between too, literally, you've got gardens on the ground, all kinds of gardens, and I mean, and then you've got a large central place where you can do dance and performance and TV if you need to, whatever it is. Global gatherings. I'm just saying. And you can have pyramids are really good for healing chambers. They're really good. They were going to build a pyramid up there at Crestone. Dr. Norma Milanovic. And Katumi was saying, build it. I'll show you how to fix it. All kinds of healing going on in all kinds of chambers inside. I wanted it to be built to the same dimensions as the Giza pyramid. Just to the slight station break since then. I mean, that was way back in the 90s. We were hanging out with Norma Milanovic and Shield and Sharula and all the folks. Really, literally excited about doing it this time, and a little station break again. And it's, the younger ones are not encumbered with stuff, you might say, in a certain way, that's true. Yet they do need to learn some of the ancient wisdoms that are, learn how to access them in themselves. I think the door needs to be shut now. It's getting a little colder. Okay, so we probably want to finish what we started, and we lost our connection for about the last 9 minutes. I don't know if you heard the last tail end of the lady that was doing dance and theater, but I'm just hoping that was so. I didn't hear anybody say it, so we're going to start with this next piece. So let's change the furniture, Rama. I got to pass this to you, and we'll go finish that first. And then we'll go listen to Richard Wolff, yada yada around the town. Okay. Tell everybody we're coming. It's coming.
It's coming. Just a minute.
Uh-oh. Hold on, everybody. I had it booted up and I forgot. Go there.
Just a moment.
Anything you want to tell them, go ahead until I queue it up.
Oh, I can just say that magic of Mr. Knuckle Bear is gonna make a lot of magic happen.
Mr. Knuckle Bear.
Yeah, bringing in the peace.
Okay. All right.
You gotta read this without moving the mic.
We'll pull the chair over here then. Okay. Go look over there and make sure.
All
Uncle
right.
Don, I have to have the mic in my hand. I don't want to lose the connection, so. You got to talk to him, Rama. Okay.
Well, he can hear you.
This is a piece by Stanley Cohen, and he's a longtime social justice attorney and activist. Where is it? Here it comes. He has represented thousands of political clients, ranging from Palestinian and indigenous resistance fighters to activists and community organizers in New York City. For 10 years, he has been subjected to investigation and harassment by various agencies of the federal government. Ultimately, leading to criminal indictments being filed against him, related to income tax. On April 14th, 2014, he accepted a deal that includes pleading guilty to impeding the IRS tax code. He was sentenced on October 21st, 2014. He is now serving 18 months in prison.
A functioning democracy and a functioning judiciary requires attorneys who are willing to step up and take clients who, for whatever reason, have been demonized by the wider society and by the state. And if essentially you snuff those attorneys out, if you disbar them, if you disenfranchise them, in the case of Stanley, potentially even send them to prison. What you're really doing is eroding the very process of an objective judicial system and democracy itself.
Criminal defense is all political. There's not a person prosecuted in this country that's not political, whether it's based on class, whether it's based on gender, whether it's based on race. There's a very fundamental common strain among my political clients. There are people who say no, they resist. They need advocates. What I do. I stand with them, I fight with them, I support them, and it's what I do. I view my work as friction on the machine. I view my work as trying to fuck with it because it's corrupt. There's systematic problems because the judges, because the prosecutors, because the police are essentially corrupt and indifferent or malignant in the whole situation. And I view myself as throwing myself into the machine. There are those that'll fight for due process, and there are some of us who challenge the system in every way, every day, from small case to large.
This has nothing to do with the IRS or tax evasion, just as we saw with the disbarring and persecution of the civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart. This is about shutting out those very few radical civil rights attorneys who are willing to stand up and take on clients who the state has demonized and who the mass public has, in essence, convicted of guilt before trial.
This case is about quieting resistance. This case is about sending a message. This case is about if you're going to silence me, if you're going to send a message to lawyers that advocate, that struggle, that push every day of the week, and if you're going to allow them to get away with it, how much weaker we all are. It's not by accident that I've been targeted. It accomplishes a lot in their mind. But I've got a surprise for them. It's not going to silence me, it's not going to change me, and it's not going to silence and change a generation of people out there that are willing to sacrifice to change this fucking world.
This is not just about protecting due process and our judiciary, but protecting what's left of our democracy itself.
You can only protect your liberties in this world by protecting the other man's freedom. You can only be free as I am free. Clarence Darrow, Darrow, 1920. They're giving an address if you want to contact him. to contact Stanley, write a letter addressed to Stanley Cohen, and I'll give you his number. It's 198-460-52, Federal Prison Camp, Canaan, C-A-N-A-A-N, P.O. Box 200, Waymart, W-A-Y-M-A-R-T, Pennsylvania, P.A., 18472. Interesting. Stanley Cohen, C-O-H-E-N, S-T-A-N-L-E-Y. Okay.
A play called My Name is Rachel Corey is returning to New York for the first time in 9 years, 12 years after its young protagonist was crushed to death beneath an Israeli military bulldozer. Derived from her speeches and correspondence, the play tells the tale of 23-year-old Rachel Corey, who died attempting to stop the demolition of a Palestinian home in Gaza in 2003. Soon after her killing, Corey's family sued the Israeli Defense Ministry in a case finally dismissed by the Israeli Supreme Court this year. 90 minutes on the New York stage is no substitute for accountability in a court of law, but it's not nothing either. And in at least one sense, My Name is Rachel is a fitting requiem for Corey. As actress activist Kathleen Chalfont put it right here, theater itself is a political act. Every single performance, she says, is the product of the people who've performed it and the people who've watched it. And the thing that is made is the thing in the middle. Corey's texts, by her own admission, are sometimes scattered, but the play still packs a punch because it summons actor and audience to think about the Middle East together, to collaborate, as Chalfont would say, in the production of an outcome. And that's just how we're not taught to think about goings-on in Gaza. There, we're taught it's a complex affair for other people, far-off men. The reality is, decades of war and occupation are a thing made in the middle, a mess made by politicians, British and American, as well as Israeli and Palestinian, voters who favor extremists, and corporations like Caterpillar, who made the bulldozer, and U.S. taxpayers who foot the bill. It's a mess made by players who perform on the world stage, in other words, and also the world audience that watch. And that's just why Corey went to Gaza, as the play, which I saw in 2006, recounts, from the state of Washington, she traveled halfway around the world to see Gaza up close and to connect with Palestinians who rarely make the news in any role other than victims or victimizers. Especially at this time, as U.S. media mesmerize us with tales of steamy ruptures in the ongoing U.S.-Israel romance, My Name is Rachel reminds us that war and occupation are outcomes in which we too play a part, as in the theater. We collaborate, as Chalfont would say, in the production of an outcome. Thanks. You can write to me and tell me what you think. Laura, L-A-U-R-A, at grittv.org.
Okay, I'm going to back it up just to see if we played just the end, because I think we lost a bit earlier before we went to our astrology section. So just hang on here. I'm going to back it up. That was too much. Okay.
Nearly 20 years ago.
I know.
And I guess my question for you has to do with that part of the world. You're on the board of the Freedom Theater of Jenin, in the West Bank. What do you see happening? What do you see in terms of signs of progress, good, bad, ugly?
I don't know. Mm. I've been saying lately, it's going to make me cry, I used to know where to go to sign up.
Yeah.
And I don't know what we are to do. I've come to believe that that the Abrahamic religions are all the same religion, and they all, those things that are good about them, faith, hope, and charity, are all good in almost the same way in all three of them, and they all go bad in the same way. They all move toward control, to some notion of the chosen people, almost immediately to patriarchy, and all that follows from patriarchy. There are the most obvious versions of it are the ones that we all know, but we are the same way of thinking is in some way all through the Western world. Yeah. You know, the rise of fascism and nativism in Europe is terrifying. The rise of nativism in America, which seems nonsense. Mm-hmm. What does that mean, nativism in America? Nobody's from here.
Right.
I once said that to Jeffrey Wright, and he said he was from here, because on both sides.
Oh, yeah.
But you have to, it's a long time, about 10,000 years ago, to actually say you are from here.
And the theater, the Freedom Theater of Jenin, has to be said, is continuing after the assassination
and the
of
freedom,
its leader.
The Freedom Theater, I think that we, in a way, the Enlightenment was an attempt to deal with the downside of the Abrahamic religions. It has its, God knows, many, many, many downsides too. In this case, what you hope for from what's left of the Enlightenment is the fact that in secular societies it isn't enshrined any longer in the Constitution, the patriarchy. And one of the great contributions, and perhaps one of the things that made Giuliano so dangerous, is that this most charismatic, incredibly sexy, most masculine of men was a great feminist.
Yeah. So before we let you go, there might be people watching who don't get any longer drama in their schools, who don't feel like they have any access to this weird world of acting, but maybe listening to you want to get a little closer. How do they do it? How do they bring theater into your life?
Well, I think the question of arts in the schools are essential. Art is not, I say this all the time, but it is true, art is not an amenity for the privileged. It is the deepest expression of the human soul. And if you take it out of education, then we will fall into the abyss more quickly. So when people talk about art as being inessential, I think we have to rise up and say that's not true. How many refrigerators are there that don't have their children's pictures stuck on them? Mm. That's not an accident. That's what people do. Barbarism is the word I was looking for. We will fall into barbarism if we allow art to be sucked away from us, if we are told that it's inessential.
So fight for it in the schools.
Fight for it in the schools. Encourage your the wonderful thing about the theater is that it happens in every home that has a small child in it, because that's what children do. They encourage your children to make up stories, to be characters, play with them the best you can, take them to places where people are doing things live, because there's nothing like it.
And you could grow up and be Kathleen Chalfant.
You can do much better than that.
Kathleen, thank you so much. And I can't wait to see the next season of The Affair.
Me too.
support that will help us long.
The use of capital and the alternatives to capitalism.
Thank you all for coming. It's a chance for me to see the faces of the people that I speak to through the radio, where you can't see anything except the little room that they put you in when you talk to the machine. So it is a very humanistic moment when I can actually see the people who send us the emails. This is a remarkable time in American history, very different from anything I expected to see, at least in my lifetime. And so I want to share with you a little bit before we get into the substance. My plan today is very modest. I'm going to tell you where the economy is and what's going to happen and what we need to do about it. And all that in 45 minutes to an hour should be either incomprehensible or brilliant or somewhere in between. So normally what I'm about to say, I only say at the end of the talk. But I'm now going to say it at the beginning, since you're going to see where I'm coming from. I'm a critic of capitalism in general, of American capitalism in particular. I have been all my adult life. What's different is in the last 3 years, I've done more public speaking than in the previous 40. And that this is a country that is changing very fast. And it isn't only changing on the right with the Tea Party. It's also changing on the left. And I know it, not by secondhand or by someone telling me, but from my own day-by-day experience. I never did a radio program in my life until BAI asked me in March of 2011 to do a one-hour program on the economy because people were interested. We're now on 42 stations across the United States, one in Australia, two in Britain, and three in Canada. And this is without one nickel or one person's time spent on doing what's called syndication, getting radio stations to do it. We've now brought a person on board who had volunteered for us and paying him a small amount, and his job is to get more stations for us. So I'm hopeful that by the end of the year we'll have at least 75 stations, and all of them are driven by the desire to understand what's going on. The American people are finally becoming aware and afraid all at the same time of what is going on, especially as the bad times seem to be taking a long time to lift. And so what I'm asked to do and what I'm going to do with you is to try to give you an overview of what happened, why it's happening, where it's likely to go, and what we ought to do about it. And I have to say, as I often do when I begin, I am not anything other than the messenger. I am explaining to you what's happening. I didn't create what I'm describing to you. So if along the way you get moments of just passing depression, remember the adage, do not shoot the messenger just because you don't like the message, okay? All right, so let's go. We are now living through the second major collapse of our U.S. capitalist and indeed the world capitalist system. The last one was in the 1930s, began in 1929, for those of you that don't remember or haven't read about this, and didn't really end until 1941, so roughly 11, 12 years. By that count, we're only halfway through, as long as it was last time, so we'll see how long and or how bad this one gets. But generally, at least so far, that one was worse than what we're living through now. The height of the unemployment rate in 1933, when it reached its worst in the Great Depression, was about 25%. That was the official count. We don't have that in this country, but Spain and Greece and other countries in Europe do have that, and they're going through what we went through back in the 1930s, and as you'll see in a few minutes, they're beginning to do the kinds of things that were done in the 1930s here, and there should be no surprise at all. Greece that you read about now, and we will have something to say about it, is a recapitulation of the kinds of things that happened in this country in the 1930s. It can only be presented the way it is in the American media if you can presume, which unfortunately we can, that your audience doesn't know its own history. So what happened in the Great Depression is a good place to start by giving us a way of getting into what's happening in this one. So let's really remember. We had a boom of the 1920s, the flapper era and all of that. And then it built up, and there was lots of speculation as the rich became richer. They struggled to make their wealth grow even faster with a kind of excitement verging on hysteria that then produced a collapse of investments that weren't wise, that were not sustainable. And we crashed October of 1929. And we were promised by the politicians of the time, Herbert Hoover and the Democrats too, that this downturn was one that we normally have every so often, nothing to worry about, won't last very long, won't cut very deep, blah, 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 blah. All of that proved wrong then, just as it did this time. But there was a fundamentally different reaction in the 1930s. The American people, as it became clear from 1929 to 30 to 31 to 32 to 33, 4, 5, 6 years into the crisis, the American people then reacted differently from the way the American people are reacting now, as we are 6 years or so into this one. What did the American people do then? Very interesting. They rose up and demanded something be done for them. They did not want to go through this crisis, which they didn't feel responsible for, from which they had already suffered. They had suffered enough. They wanted something done. So the first thing that happened was millions of Americans joined labor unions. You've probably noticed that something similar is not happening today. Millions, I'm talking many millions, who had never been in a union before, who came from families where neither mother nor father had ever been involved in a union. They joined a union because they saw it as a way to get a better shake during this horrible depression of the 1930s. Together with the unions mobilizing and organizing. By the way, they were the most successful union drive in American history. We had never had anything like it before. We have never had anything like it since. Nothing. It's an absolute unique moment in American history. Working with the trade unions at the time were two socialist parties and the American Communist Party. And for those of you who don't know this history, yes, we had those parties, and they were big and they were powerful. And I only mention this because of the old rule that if it has happened in the past, dot, dot, dot. But I'll leave you to speculate on what that might mean. Here's what the socialists and the communists and the unions did. They mobilized tens of millions of people into Communist Party, Socialist Party, but the big one, of course, the union movement, were much larger than the socialists or the communists. But they worked very closely together. And in the depths of the Depression, when the unemployment rate was 25%, 25% means one out of every four workers is unemployed. If one out of every four workers is unemployed, it means every family in the United States has somebody who's in that situation. So there's nothing strange, nothing foreign, nothing weird, and nothing unclear about what's going on. Everybody knows. No escape. And as the months go by and the years go by, the unemployed people then had no unemployment insurance. Nobody gave them a check every week because they were unemployed. So they very quickly ran out of the few savings they had. They became burdens on their family and friends. Again, you know what that means because we're going through that now in this country. So what happened? The communists, socialists, and unions, they went to the president of the United States and they basically said, politely, because one does this politely, but no one is mystified by what's going on. They said politely, Mr. Roosevelt, you've got to do something for the people of this country who are suffering from a depression they did not cause. You've bailed out the big banks. They did that in the beginning of the depression then, just like we did it now. But that's not enough, Mr. President. You got to take care of us, too. And if you don't, You know that thing that happened over there in Russia in 1917? It's going to happen here, too. And Mr. Roosevelt was a smart politician. He understood this was no bluff. They had the millions of people lined up. And they basically said to him, if you don't, we won't vote for you. And if we don't vote for you, your chances are not really good. They're like zero. And Mr. Roosevelt went to the rich and the corporations of America, people he knew well because that's where he came from. And he told them the story. You've got to work with me, he said. You've got to give me the money to take care of the mass of the American people. And I'm going to tell you why you've got to do that. Because if you don't, you won't have any money to give anybody ever again. He scared them. Half of them were persuaded. Half of them never were. The half who never were are the core of the Koch brothers and all of that. That's just the lineage. You can show it goes right back. But the half he won over was all Roosevelt needed. He went back to the unions, the socialists and the communists, and he said, okay, I'm going to take care of the mass of your people. But there's a deal here. I'll get the money and I'll do it. You've got to stop talking about revolution. No more of that. Don't threaten me. Don't talk about that. Because if you do, the deal is off. And the unions and the socialists and the communists basically bought the deal. And then Roosevelt delivered. He went on the radio and created the Social Security system. We had no such thing in this country. In the depths of the Depression, when there's no money because everybody's unemployed and can't pay any taxes, where could you get the money to do anything? You couldn't, you know, do anything. Suddenly, you're able to say to every person over 65, I'm going to give you a check every month for the rest of your life, no matter how long you live. What? In the midst of a Depression? Better, said Roosevelt. As soon as he was finished, he said, I'm creating the unemployment compensation system. If you get unemployed through no fault of your own, I'm going to give you a check every week for a couple of years. This is at a time when there were tens of millions of unemployed. He said, we're not done. I'm going to create a minimum wage. That's when it began in the United States. We had no such thing. We had no Social Security. We had no unemployment compensation. We had no minimum wage. He said, I'm still not done. He went on the radio and he gave an amazing speech. Went like this, paraphrase. If the private sector of our economy cannot provide jobs to the millions of Americans who ask only to be given a job, then it's obvious, this president, it's obvious that I have to do it. So between 1934 and 1941, 15 million jobs were created working for the federal government, and they were filled by unemployed Americans. A public employment program. Not the least of the amazing development of the ideological befuddlement of the American people is the fact that over the last 5 years, as we suffer from record unemployment, there is no public debate about the program that worked last time we were in this situation. What an achievement. We didn't even discuss it. We didn't even debate it. Neither Bush nor Obama acted as though they had ever taken a course to learn what I just told you. What? And here's the best part. The president who took care of the old people, took care of the unemployed people, jacked up the minimum wage, and hired 15 million people in the middle of a depression. Where did he get the money to do? That's very expensive. And the answer, for those of you that are Americans, is something I need to say twice. Ready? Here's the first time. He taxed corporations and the rich. I'm going to do it a second time. He taxed corporations and the rich. Hugely. Hugely. So in case you thought that can't be done because there's somewhere in Scripture where it's forbidden. Not the case. Not the case. He went and he taxed them. Hugely. I'm going to give you in a minute some of the numbers. But I want you to see what happened to a politician who dared to contravene the usual advice given to American presidents, which is never do what I just described. Never tax corporations and the rich to help the average person. The reason you should never do that is that you'll kiss your political career goodbye. Franklin Roosevelt did it. I mean, granted, he had to do it with the pressure from below, but he did it. And the reward for him was that he became the most popular president in the history of the United States. He was reelected 4 times. No other person ever was. Guess what? It turns out that if you tax corporations and the rich for the benefit of the mass of people, they love you. And when they love you, they vote for you. And then you become politically invincible. That makes the half of the corporations, the rich, who never bought this game, furious. It makes them enraged. It also terrifies them. Because I can see where the next step of such an approach might lead. But it is the truth. In 1944, President Roosevelt sent the following message to Congress as part of his State of the Union message. He proposed that the top income tax rate levied on wealthy people would be 100%. Let me explain to you what that means. Every dollar over $25,000 that you earned in a year, that would be about $380,000, $390,000 a year now, adjusted for the change of prices. So every dollar over $25,000 you would earn, said the president, would be taxed at 100%, which means every dollar you earned over $25,000, you wouldn't earn over $25,000 because the government would take it all. That's called a maximum income. He had installed a minimum wage, and now he was going to, Pharisees, install a maximum income. Well, you can imagine when he sent that bill to the Congress, the Republicans went ballistic, and not a few Democrats along with them. And they yelled and they screamed, and then socialism, all the usual noise. And then they reached a compromise, which the Republicans signed off and the Democrats signed off and the president signed. What was the top income tax rate in 1944? For those of you who don't remember, I'm being kind here. 94%. Every dollar over $25,000 you earned, Uncle Sam took 94 cents and you kept 6. Don't say that can't happen in America. It already did. The maximum income tax rate today is 39%. Taxes on rich people were dropped from 1944 to today by an enormous amount, from 94 to 39. Rich people have had a wonderful 50 years. You, by contrast, haven't, from which you should draw some lesson. Well, what happened? What happened is simple. Once the Depression was behind us, and once World War II was behind us, two things of importance happened. Franklin Roosevelt died at the end of World War II, as I assume you all know. And the Republicans immediately pushed through a law that no president could serve more than 2 terms. They didn't want that to happen again, especially knowing how it was achieved. And the second thing is that the right wing in America, which is a polite way of saying wealthy corporations and the rich, they went to work to undo what had just happened. Oh boy, they went to work with gusto and they did it very well. They understood that the problem was not Mr. Roosevelt. The problem was the coalition that had formed out of the suffering of the Great Depression, the unions, the socialists, and the communists. They knew they had to destroy that coalition if they weren't going to face comparable economic policies from future presidents the way they had under Roosevelt. So they identified the weak link in that coalition. And the weak link was the American Communist Party. So they went to work to transform communists from leading militants who worked to organize unions into the terribly evil agents of a terrible empire located somewhere east of the Hudson River. And we learned in this country to be very scared of communism. It was awkward, took a while, because we had, and I know in my younger audiences, when I say what I'm about to say, it comes as a shock. For those of you that are older, it won't be a shock. But it was hard to focus on the communists as evil because we had just been in an alliance with the Soviet Union in the World War. When in many American post offices between 1939 or 40 and 1945, you would see a big picture hanging over the post clerk's office as you went in to buy stamps, and there would be Uncle Sam arm in arm with Uncle Joe. Uncle Joe was Stalin. And right there under the American flag was Stalin, put there by the U.S. Post Office to build the solidarity that we were supposed to feel. It kind of hard within a few months to make a demon out of an ally. But where there's a will, there's a way. And as soon as we demonized the communists, arrested them, deported them, made them out to be the people who want to, you know, eat your pet dog or whatever it is that was useful to frighten Americans. And as soon as that was done, that was clear, then what was next? The next thing would be to go around the United States and explain to people, you know these people, these socialists? They're the same thing. They just spell it differently. Right? So it's social. You know, when I first learned this, I was a young teacher here in the United States. I was born and raised in the United States, like I assume most of you were. And I was a young teacher, and I noticed that when I went to Europe, everybody understood crystal clearly what is the difference between a communist, a socialist, an anarchist, a Marxist. They got that. Whereas here in the United States, when I would say words like communist, socialist, Marxist, anarchist, my students had an immediate understanding. These were all synonyms. It's all the same thing. They just spell it differently. You know, and I thought at first, my God, these are uneducated young people. No. They were very well educated. They thought it was the same because that was the message. Being involved in any left-wing collective political action became way too dangerous. Whether it was communists or socialists, and as soon as they destroyed the socialists, I assume you all know that communist and socialist parties in the United States today barely exist and have virtually no influence on anything, in most cases, that is of a political nature. Then they went to work on the labor movement. And they've done a good job there, too. For those of you who don't know, 6.8% of the private labor force in the United States is either a member of or represented by a union. 93% of the private sector has no union. The next time a politician gets up and talks about how he is going to protect us against big labor, you're listening to an idiot. Or worse, someone who's playing on the hope. But no one knows the numbers I just gave you, numbers that come from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is the United States government that counts all these things. But you know better. You need to inform your fellow citizens. So we destroyed the American left. We wrecked it. We destroyed the organizations, the linkages, the networks, the mutual trust, all of the things that make for a political movement. And once that was destroyed, and a little footnote here, because I know some of you will ask me this later. Why is it that in Europe, you will ask me, they have demonstrations and general strikes, and they've been fighting against austerity, now reaching the culmination for the first time in modern European history, that an organization committed not only to fight austerity and to do the kinds of things Roosevelt did, but a political movement comes to power, one of whose basic slogans is the sentence, Greece can do better than capitalism. The new leadership in Greece that just won overwhelming mandate at the polls, a movement called Syriza, led by a man named Alex Tsipras, and whose finance minister, a fellow some of you may see in the press a lot, named Yanis Varoufakis, who used to teach economics with me here in the United States and has got his degree here and so forth. These are people who don't happen yet in the United States. And why is that? The answer is, in Europe, the destruction of the coalitions that built up in the 1930s never happened the way it happened here. There's no mystery about why we, as a left in America, remain numerically strong but organizationally bereft. That's a result of our history, just like the fact that they're much better organized in Europe is a result of their different history. Every European country has communist parties, socialist parties, and so on, that are full of large numbers of people and who wield real political power. That's because the anti-destruction of their coalitions of the 30s never happened like it happened here. For the left to regain its strength in this country will require it to overcome that part of its history that didn't just destroy those organizations, but planted very deep in the American psychological consciousness a fundamental anxiety about being involved in left-wing organizations. You traumatize the people and they show the trauma. They're very leery. So unless there's an automatic institution that says to the left, here's an organization, just use it, and there's nobody willing to do that, the Democratic Party won't do that. They're too afraid. The Republican Party does that for the Tea Party. Nobody does that for the American left. That's the equivalent, and that's our history.
That is such a powerful analysis by economist Richard Wolff. And we're going to be right back shortly with more of his talk. But in
a minute, everybody.
There's nothing to criticize. It's just a wonderful system. This is the way my students have come to me for 50 years, with that in their heads, more or less. We have debated as a nation. Every one of the systems that make up American society, our school system, our transportation system, last few years we've been debating our health insurance system, and so, but with one exception, capitalism, no need to debate that. That's simply the best thing since sliced bread, and anybody who's not crazy or perverse or evil knows it. My professors did never think it was necessary to justify to us the capitalist system that we were studying. It simply was the best. End of conversation. That was it. And those of us who asked questions saying, well, what about, were cut off in mid-sentence and told either that that's an inappropriate question or go to somebody else and ask, go to a sociologist or go to a philosopher. It's a little bit like going to one of your parents when you're a teenager and asking the difficult questions about sex and having them send you to the other parent, and then you bounce back and forward because neither of them is comfortable enough to talk to you. Well, it was a little bit like that. For us, I had to learn a critical perspective on capitalism on my own, outside of my university training. So, what was that about? It was about a society that couldn't debate its own economic system. And here's a little piece of advice. If you don't deal with the problems in your economic system, you're like giving it a free pass to indulge its worst tendencies, its worst instincts, because there's no risk of identifying them, no risk of public debate over them. And that's very dangerous. Like, not going to a doctor or not listening to the doctor early on when they detect something, and you let it get worse and worse, then by the time you deal with it, it's a much bigger problem. Economics is just the same. We are in a pickle now, partly because we refused to debate the pros and cons of our capitalist system for 50 years. It was a taboo. I could see it as I was getting my education. No professor dared do that. No student, after a while, was dumb enough to risk his or her career by pushing in that direction. If we studied this stuff like I did, we did it quietly. And I might mention, just so you know, that I'm the product of the so-called best education this country can provide. I went to Harvard for my BA. Then I went to Stanford for my master's. And then I got my PhD at Yale. It's like a joke, only it's true. I have all the pedigrees, all the credentials. And let me make it real clear. Capitalism, the system we have, is a disaster. It's serious. I sit with my colleagues, right-wing professors, left-wing professors, and folks in the middle. We don't agree on how it got into this situation we're in today, and we don't agree on how to get out of it. But here's what we all agree on. This is the worst condition of the American economy any of us have seen in our lifetimes. And for those of you who imagine we are on some road to recovery, wow. Sorry, not the case. We haven't recovered from anything. We haven't learned anything. We were on an economic train heading right into a stone wall in 2007, and we hit the stone wall. And we have changed fundamentally nothing about how this economy works in the intervening 7 years. Guess what? We're on the train again, and it's going in the same direction, and the wall is still there. Only now the speculation is in auto loans instead of home mortgages, in student debt instead. But other than that, it's the same story. The gap between rich and poor is wider now than it was in 2007. The big banks that were too big to fail in 2007, they're bigger now than they were then. Everything that has happened is the result of an economic system that doesn't work for the mass of the people. And it hasn't for a long time. It stopped in the 1970s. You can make an argument before then that in American history, the capitalist system, whatever its strengths and weaknesses, lifted up the standard of living of the mass of people. Compared to other countries, it did. And if that's your measure of a successful system, it did pretty well. But since the 1970s, it's not doing that. And it's not going to do it. And it's not going to do it for a long time, if ever. Why? Why are we in this situation? Well, first, let me make sure you understand what has happened. Starting in the 1970s, capitalists in the United States, big businesses, began to understand something that their counterparts in Europe and Japan also understood. And this history is indispensable to understand what's happening to us. Here's what they understood. That in the first 200 or 300 years of capitalism's history, it built itself up in the places where it was born. England, Europe, North America, Japan. That's where the factories were put. That's where the storehouses were put. That's where the stores were built and the offices were erected, etc., etc. And along the way, the rest of the world was reorganized to feed this core, to provide the food, to provide the raw materials, to provide the workers, and finally to provide a good bit of the market for the output. Many of you had a cup of coffee this morning, and you put some sugar in it. We don't produce coffee in this country, and we don't produce sugar either. You had to rely on imported food, etc., etc. So in this capitalist system, what was the great recognition? Well, not only did we build up our system by concentrating production in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, but along the way, the workers in those parts of the world said, hey, we want a piece of this too. We don't want to live in the horrible conditions of early capitalism. And for those of you who think you don't know what those conditions were, you do. Just remember if you ever read Charles Dickens, or Emile Zola, or Maxim Gorky, or Jack London, or any one of 1,000 others who recorded what early capitalism was like. So the working class demanded a piece of the very successful system that they were working in, and they got it. Wages rose in North America, Western Europe, and Japan. Meanwhile, in the rest of the world that were the providers of the food and the raw materials, the standard of living went down. We became well off, and the rest of the world not. So what happened in the 1970s? No mystery. The capitalists looked around and said, you know, there have been these two technological breakthroughs that change everything. One is the jet engine. We can get to any corner of the globe in a matter of hours. Number two, the computer and modern telecommunications. We can locate a factory anywhere because with modern telecommunications, we can monitor what happens on that factory floor, what happens in the bathroom, what happens in the parking lot. We can keep track of everything. We don't need to produce where the wages are high, which is where? North America, Western Europe, and Japan. Why not? Because we can move. We can move to where the wages are very low in India and China and Brazil. And they started moving in the 1970s, and they never stopped. Here's a statistic you should never, ever put out of your mind. If you adjust the wages Americans get for the prices they pay to get what we call in economics the real wage, how much stuff your wage can actually allow you to buy. What good is it to have twice as much money in your pocket if you pay twice the prices for everything? You're not one step ahead. So what has happened to the real wage? The average real wage in the United States is what it was in 1978. There's been no increase. For the last 40 years, American workers have been more and more productive because of the computer and everything else. To say that workers are more productive means that the average worker in an hour gives to his or her boss more than they used to. Rising productivity means workers give more to the employer. But a flat real wage means that what the employer gives to the worker hasn't gone up at all. Let me do that again. For 40 years, the wage you get for the work you do is the same. But what you produce for your employer goes up every year. That's why the employers have become very wealthy and you haven't. How did Americans keep themselves from blowing up with rage, upset, and anger? The solution was that Americans became pioneers again, but this time not rolling across the prairie in a colorful line of wagons. No, the way we became a pioneer was we as a people undertook the greatest borrowing binge anywhere in the history of the human race. No working class had ever borrowed money the way we have in the last 40 years. We maintained the illusion of a rising standard of living when the conditions to actually have one were no longer present. What we didn't get rising wages for, we borrowed. Until, and this you don't need a PhD for, until the day came when people who had a flat wage but a rising level of debt discovered on that wage, you can't repay that debt. It's over. That's 2007, and the bubble collapsed. The houses, people couldn't stay in their homes. They couldn't make their mortgage payments at the same time that they made their credit card payments. By the way, when did credit cards become a mass form of debt? In the 1970s. How coincidental? Not at all. Americans became debt peons, people worried sick all the time about how they're going to pay that MasterCard bill at the end of the month, until they learned that wonderful system where your bill says $842, and then it says, but as long as you give us $15.24 at the end of the month, you're golden. Why? Because then they can charge you interest for all that you're accumulating. It's a wonderful system if you want to sink your population into debt. That's what we did. That's how we kept the illusion. The great go-go years of Reagan and Clinton were built on a house of debt cards. There was no reality to it. But in a go-go time, nobody asks any questions. And so we roared ahead. Meantime, the jobs are leaving. There are no jobs. At first, it was just manufacturing jobs moving to India and China. You all know that. You've all noticed as you put on your shirt and take it off that it says made in and never USA anymore, does it? You know where it's made, in Bangladesh. Or, and why? Is there a mystery here? No. What's the minimum wage in Bangladesh right now? $38 a month. How are you going to compete with it? You cannot make shoes or socks or slips or blouses in this country if you're competing against Bangladesh. Especially because in Bangladesh, not only do they pay nothing to their workers, but they cram thousands of them into tiny spaces, which periodically collapse. And as you know from last year, can kill thousands of people in horrible fires, reminiscent of the early days of capitalism everywhere else. We're in very deep trouble. Now the jobs that are leaving aren't so much manufacturing, although that's still going on, but the jobs are in services. All across the country, the number of people going to law school has collapsed. Why? Because more and more of the grunt work of legal work is done overseas. You send what you need to a proofreader in India who can do all this. There are no jobs for junior lawyers. The whole thing, blueprints are not made in the United States anymore. You have an architect, needs a blueprint. It goes by telecommunication someplace else where you pay a fraction of it. Many of you are going to discover in the years ahead that when you need an operation, the first thing you're going to get is an airline. No, your insurance company will explain to you. We will take care of what you need. Here's a ticket. A limousine will pick you up, take you to the nearest airport. You will fly to India. You will be picked up by an ambulance there. You'll be taken to a hospital. The doctor who does the operation got his degree at Johns Hopkins Medical School, just like your doctor in your local clinic, and then we'll put you in a recovery, and then we'll fly you back. And why will we do that? Because it's much cheaper, since a surgeon in India gets $20,000 a year, and a surgeon in the United States gets $20,000 an hour, or whatever they're going. You know the story. You do know what's going on. Even if you didn't put it all together, you really all do know what is going on. Capitalism won the support of the American people from its beginnings, and our beginnings as an independent nation, to the 1970s, because whatever happened to us on the job, we were able, when that job was over, to take our pay and recover all that we had lost during the work hours by going to the mall. Or stopping between the job and the mall at a place which very wisely called what it offered happy hour. Helping you to realize what the nature of the hours before that had been. So Capitalism squeezes you, but compensates you with consumption. That was its way of surviving until the 1970s. Now American capitalism says to you, the American people, bye-bye. I'm out of here. I'm leaving. I'm not leaving for any reason different than I ever did anything. It's more profitable. I've done what's most profitable. That's what capitalism as a system has me do. That's what I've been trained to do. That's what they taught me to do to get my MBA, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm doing it. I'm going to China. I'm going to India. I'm going to Brazil. And I'm going to leave behind here wreckage. Wreckage. I'm gone. So I offer you, the American people, what? No jobs. Lousy jobs. No support from the government, because we're not paying taxes here. We're paying taxes over there. Because that's our future. That's where the growth is. Here, you in America, you are, and beware when you hear this, you are a mature economy. Watch out. Someone calls you mature, that's not a compliment. No. Means you're not growing anymore. And all good capitalists know, you do not want to be dependent on the place that isn't growing. You want to be active where the growth is, and it's not here, and it hasn't been. What did it mean for us? Okay, here's the part where I want you to remember I'm just a messenger, okay? What you ought to think about is Detroit, Cleveland, Camden, New Jersey, my hometown, Youngstown, Ohio, and thousands more like it. But I'm going to use Detroit because it's the most stark example. In 1970, the population of Detroit was 1.9 million people. It was the center of the successful capitalist enterprise of the United States. Presidents would bring leaders of foreign countries and take them to Detroit to see the booming automobile factories, GM, Chrysler, Ford, all of that. It was the first place where African Americans could come north from the South and get a job and earn good money and be part of what was then the most powerful union in the United States, the United Auto Workers, the UAW. It was such a successful, booming economy that it developed a whole new world music, the Motown sound that all of you must have heard, even if you couldn't identify it as that, because now part of world music. It was a cultural center, a political powerhouse. Wow. And what is Detroit now? The population of Detroit last year was counted. 700,000 people. That means the majority of the people of that city were driven out of the city by the collapse of that economy. One of the biggest problems, and believe me, you can check all of this through the marvels of modern telecommunications. One of the biggest problems in Detroit today is, I only mention this because the metaphor is so stark, is the problem of wild dogs. What happened? Detroit is an economic basket case. It's actually in formal bankruptcy now, those of you who keep track of these things. Largest bankruptcy in American urban history. And along the way, they had no money. Nobody's working. Nobody lives there anymore. So no taxes are coming in, so the city can't do anything. And one of the first things they got rid of were the dog wardens. You know, the people that have those trucks and go around pick up stray dogs. Right? They're not doing that. Meanwhile, as millions of people leave, desperately poor, having lost everything, they can't sustain Fido too well either. So they bid a farewell, teary, to Fido, and they take off and leave for another city, and Fido. But Fido does have one problem he does not have. Since about a third of the houses in Detroit are abandoned, there's plenty of places where Fido can go and receive shelter from the storm. Unfortunately, Fido and Fidette do things, which of course I will not describe, and therefore there are lots of dogs who are wild. And it's a serious problem of attacks on children from, let's do that again. The most powerful country in the world has the center of its capitalist success in the 1970s, now having become a semi-desert in which marauding gangs of wild dogs threaten children. If you don't understand what that means, then you need a different kind of help from anything I can provide with you. Here's the hard part of this, and I don't know how to say this in a nice way. The holiday of American capitalism, which was never much of a holiday for many around the world, but was a sort of one for people here. That's over. And that's not coming back anytime soon. That's why this crisis happened. That's why this crisis wasn't short and shallow, but was long and deep. And that's why when this crisis is over, the long-term trajectory of this society is in deep trouble and in, at this point, a level of decline that is going to sooner or later impress itself relentlessly on the awareness of Americans, even with a population like ours that is so carefully trained not to see it, not to face it, to turn instead to the television, to a world of utter make-believe. Now complete with Google glasses and all the rest that'll help you avoid seeing what is actually there so that you can live in the simulacrum of what life is like. This is a very serious business. And it's not going to be solved by another law or another reform. Really, folks, we've been there. We've done that. In the 1930s with Roosevelt, we had one reform after another. They've all been undone or gotten around or eviscerated. We're not increasing Social Security in the midst of the second collapse of capitalism. We're in the process of dismantling it. And as I told you before, we didn't even discuss a public employment program. And the minimum wage has not been raised as prices have gone up. So it's in fact gone down across the last couple of decades. This is a joke. We are being abandoned by capitalism. And the real political question for Americans is, will you accept this? Are you really going to hunker down and wait it out and tell yourself one story after? This is the first generation of students who can't get a degree unless they've got $50,000 in debt. What do you think that means? And you're going to get $50,000 in debt to get a degree that gives you a ticket to what? There's a Starbucks a block and a half from my home in New York City. I'm sitting there a month or two ago. A young woman, maybe 23, 24 years of age, comes in. She's shy. She's nervous. You can see it the way she carries herself. But she goes up to the, what's that term that I, a barista, a fellow making the coffee. We don't have people making coffee. We have baristas. Yeah. We don't have bus drivers. We have transportation engineers. You know, we need that. Well, when your salary is going nowhere, it's important at least your title goes up. So she goes to the barista, and he says, well, you know, what can I make for you? He thinks she wants a coffee of some kind. And she explains, no, I'd like an application form. I'd like to fill out a form. And he has a very sweet look, this fellow. And he says to her, look, honey, I'm sitting close enough, I can hear the conversation. Do you have a BA degree? He asks her. He's just being nice. And she looks kind of sad at him and says, no, not yet, her phrase. And then he explains to her, if you don't have a BA degree, I mean, fill out the form, I'll be glad to take it from you, I'll put it in the pile. They're not going to hire you. Nobody gets hired here who doesn't have a BA. She points to the guy doing the dishes in the corner with those machines. She says, you see him? He has a BA. Why? Because they can. That's why. Do you need a BA to do the work? Of course not. But why not? We have a system that isn't going to be providing jobs to millions of people. That's the major reason. And I say this as a person whose lifelong life has been an academic, been a professor of economics all my life, part of the academic world. But if you haven't figured this out, let me be the first one to tell you. Why do we have this crazy system where I sit and give lectures and you take a little exam during an hour halfway through? When, for all I know, you could have a stomach ache or your boyfriend or your girlfriend just had a big fight with you or whatever it is, and you didn't do all that well, and I say, you're a C. What? I don't know your capability. I haven't the faintest idea. Nothing you just did would show me in any unambiguous way what you're capable of. Why am I being asked to do this absurd activity? If you really wanted me to give an assessment of how good you are, you'd need to give me a class with 4 to 6 people in it. Then I could work with you, and I'd have some sense of it. But if you give me 30, let alone 300, then this is a silly joke. You're wasting the students' time and my time. Why are you doing this? But there's a clear answer. Here's the answer. We don't have anywhere near enough jobs for all the people with the capability, the desire, and the motivation to fill them. So we've got a problem. We've got to say to millions of young Americans, now more than ever, there's nothing here for you. We're really sorry you racked up all those debts, but there's nothing here. This society has no option. That's what it's doing every day. But we've got a serious political problem, because if you actually honestly told people this is a system unable to provide you with a way of being productive, creative member of the community, That would be an invitation to make the following judgment. This system stinks. It's not able to. Here I am, ready to go. I want to work. We can't have that. We can't answer that question honestly because it's politically explosive. So here's what we do. We run you through a little game. We give you exams. And we give you grades. And the point is then to be able to say, like that barista to that young woman, you're not getting this job because you have a bad grade. You don't have a degree. You got a C. You took the wrong courses. You majored in the wrong topic. You went to the wrong university. Bottom line, what's the common message here? It's your fault. There's no system problem. There's no society or economy that has failed you. No, 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 no. It's your fault. So I am required to grade students as if they were a big potato, a medium potato, or a little potato. Except people aren't potatoes and young people are not measured by the mechanisms we use, but that's not the point. The point is to make sure you blame yourself for what is denied to you. An economic system ought to provide work to the people who live with it. And if the system can't, it's time to say to the system, bye-bye. And after all, if the system is already saying bye-bye to you, it's only fair to say, no, 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 you got it wrong. Bye-bye to you. What would that mean? And I'm going to end with this. Here's what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean the traditions of socialism and communism in the sense that most of you probably think about those. Those are systems in which the government takes a major role instead of private enterprise. The government runs the enterprises. And instead of the market being the system that we use to distribute goods, we have government planning. That's been the traditional definitions of socialism and communism. It's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a fundamental alternative way of organizing production, not who owns and not how we distribute. I'm putting aside those questions. They're good questions. They're perfectly good debate, government versus private, market versus plan. But that's not what I'm wanting you to focus on. I want you to think about something else, an alternative way of organizing the production of goods and services from the one we live with. Instead of an enterprise, it's what we call them, or a business or a firm, in which we have a capitalist arrangement, which I'm going to define for you in a minute, I'm going to propose an alternative, and I'm going to try to show you why it's better and why it would solve our problem, and therefore, why we ought to do that now to get out of the hole we have worked our way into.
Richard Wolff really shakes up the economics establishment when he takes on capitalism. Hi, I'm Kim Spencer. I'm one of the founders of Link TV.
As soon as you finish making it. That's why it's so hard for toddlers. See, toddlers, when they learn to play in the sandbox and they have their truck and another little kid comes and takes the truck or takes the dolly, they're outraged. This is mine. That's a moment of difficulty that parents have to help the kid through. But we as adults have learned this, so we know that it's normal every day to go to work very hard, pour yourself into something which is immediately taken away from you and over whose disposition you have absolutely no say whatsoever. That's how capitalist enterprises work. The mass of people are excluded from any participation in deciding what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, or what to do with the profits. If you are excluded from those decisions, since those decisions affect your life is affected by what you produce and how you produce it and where it's produced and what's done with the fruits of your labor. That affects you. If you're excluded from any decision over what affects you, we call that the absence of democracy. See, democracy is if a decision affects you, you must be able to participate in making the decision. That's the idea. That means that the corporation is an institution from which democracy is excluded, period. In the United States, adults spend most of their lives at work. 5 out of 7 days, the best hours of the day, you are in an institution that excludes democracy. You live in a country that fights wars around the world in the name of a democracy it doesn't have. You that the workplace is devoid of the democracy and the democratic values you think you're committed to. How did that get worked out, would you wonder? And why is this so important? Because you could organize it another way. You could make it a democratic organization. What would it mean? It would mean something very simple. That the decisions, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits, are made democratically by everybody. You know, at the Christmas party, when you're there and you're halfway in the tank, the head of the company usually stands up on a chair. He's further along into the tank than you are, usually. And he makes a wobbly speech in which he says something like, I want to thank you all for the contribution each and every one of you made to the well-being and the profits of our company. Wow, he recognizes that everybody helps make the profits. Well, if everybody helped make them, how come everybody doesn't have some sort of say in what's done with what everybody helped to produce? And the answer is, that's how capitalism works. Your job is to come here, work, and produce. What happens, what you produce, and how you produce, none of your business. What do you think we have here? A democracy. We have a business, and that's not the way business works. Well, why would I want to think about this? Here's the conclusion, the punchline. Once upon a time, we all lived in things that had kings. We were told by the kings and their advisors that if we didn't have a king, I mean, the society would fall apart and we couldn't survive. The king was necessary to adjudicate. The king was necessary to talk to the deity on our behalf. The king was crucial. And if we ever cut the head off of the king, the society would fall apart. And then a day came, condensing the history here, when we sliced off the heads of these kings, and guess what? They died, we didn't. They weren't there anymore, we were. We survived, so did civilization. So did civilization. Your anxiety, some of you, that if you had a democratic enterprise, then there wouldn't be the boss, there wouldn't be the boss. Yes, that's the point. There wouldn't be a boss. Or to say it otherwise, your job would now have a new definition. You do particular tasks, but you also have to participate in the collective job of being the boss. My students say to me for 50 years, the thing they want most of all is to be their own boss. Good, I tell them, here's a way to get that. Get rid of the capitalist system. It's the big obstacle. And if you substitute a democratic workplace, you'll actually be your own boss. And now I'm going to show you how that would solve our problems very quickly. The book does it in detail, Democracy at Work, which is why the title. Let's imagine a group of workers together making decisions, a democratic workplace. Now the question arises, we could close the factory here in sunny Sonoma and reopen it in Shanghai. It's much more profitable there. The capitalists, the shareholders, that's great. We'll make more profit, bigger dividends for us. The stock will go up, move to Shanghai. They close the factory. Sonoma gets to look like Detroit. Dogs become your problem. Suppose the work. That's who sees the potential here. Ha 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 ha! Suppose the workers collectively made the decision. You think they'd vote together to destroy their own jobs? To destroy the money that their jobs pay the local town to provide for the schools? Come on, you know the answer. If the workers made the decisions, that exodus of American jobs I've been telling you about would never happen. It wouldn't happen. They're not going to do that. They're not going to do it for the same automatic logic that makes a capitalist decide to do it. Let me give you another example. A new technology. It enables you to produce more widgets or whatever it is you make in your factory than you could before, but it pollutes the air and it pollutes the water. The board of directors sitting, you know, in New York City, they can see they're going to make more money, so they have that technology. You don't like it? Move. Get another job. You're free. So we have pollution. But suppose the workers made it themselves. They'd be polluting themselves, their spouses, their children, their neighbors, their community. They might do it, but they would be less likely, a lot. You want to do something about the environment? This is the way to do it. Make the people who make the decisions have to live with the consequences of the polluting decisions they make. They'll make them a lot less often. Here's another example. We in America like to believe, and if you want in the question and answer period, I'd be glad to talk about it, that we are troubled by the fact that our society is becoming a country of a very few very rich people and then everybody else is in difficulty. But as an economist, let me explain to you how that happens. If you permit a tiny number of people to gather into their hands the bulk of the wealth of society, you really can't be very surprised if they give that wealth to themselves. Come on. We have boards of directors at General Motors. Those are 20 people. They sit on top of profits in the billions every year. Are you really surprised that they decide to give huge salaries to a dozen of them at the top and to distribute huge dividends to shareholders? Meanwhile, the average worker at General Motors hasn't got enough to send his kid to college. You've left the decision in the hands of people who do with that power something that can't surprise any of us. Why you shake your fist at the inequality? It's simply the flip side of allowing things to be made this way. If workers together in a factory or an office or a store decided what to do with the profits they all helped to produce, guess what? Would they give a few people huge amounts of money and everybody else can't make it? No. They might give some more than others for all kinds of reasons. But the range of inequality would be small.
Blink TV's viewer contributions make it possible to bring a vibrant mix of documentaries, global news, and diverse programs to millions of Americans.
In the best of you, centuries. Everything I'm saying to you is hypothetical.
Imagine the impact your generous gift will have for many months to come.
And in case you wonder about this and you think everything I'm saying to you is hypothetical, final point. Workers' democratically organized enterprises exist all around the world, and they have for centuries. The Mondragon Corporation is one I often refer to, and not only because the group here runs tours there, which is a wonderful opportunity for all of you to take advantage of, but I use it because it's such a successful example. 1956, northern Spain, a very poor part of the world, the Basque country in the sloping hills coming off of the Pyrenees Mountains that separate France from Spain. And there is a priest, a Catholic priest, who looks around to a very poor parish. This is after the Spanish Civil War, which laid waste to the whole country in the 30s, and then World War II, very poor. And he says to his parishioners, if we wait for capitalists to come here and provide us with jobs, we'll all die of old age before that happens. So I've got an idea. As your priest, let's become our own employer. Let's become our own boss. Let's start a worker co-op, for lack of a better term. So he does this. Man, his name is Arizmendi. For those of you that have been to the Bay Area, you'll know that there is a chain of bakeries in the Bay Area called the Arizmendi Bakeries, named after this priest. because they use that system. It's a democratic workplace. It's run that way. But Mondragon is more interesting. Why? Because in the 60 years it's been around, 56 to the present, it has grown from 6 workers that it started to over 100,000. It's the 7th largest corporation in all of Spain. Over those years, it has competed against countless capitalist enterprises and beaten them in the competition, sometimes even absorbing them. It is an amazing success. It has its own university, as you heard. It has its own pension system. It has its own bank. It has its own research labs. And 2 American companies, really excited about the quality of the research, pay the Mondragon worker co-ops a fee to allow their scientists to work alongside the Mondragon scientists. And I thought you might like to know the name of the 2 corporations, General Motors and Microsoft. So here's a successful co-op. We have them in the United States. We have them in Italy. In Italy, we have a wonderful example, and I'll conclude with that. In 1985, Italy, which has a traditional problem of unemployment, passed a law after the name of the legislator named Marcora, who pushed it through the Italian parliament. The law is still on the books. Here's how the law works. If you become unemployed in Italy, you have a choice, a plan A and a plan B. Plan A is to get a weekly stipend, the way we do here in the United States, your unemployment payment for a certain number of weeks. But you don't have to do that. You can choose an option, plan B. And here's how it works. The Italian government says, we'll give you the entire, whatever it is, 2 years of weekly payments up front as a lump sum right now. On the following 2 conditions, you have to get at least 9 other unemployed workers to make the same decision with you, and you have to pool that money as the startup capital for a worker co-op. That's the law. And the idea is we'll end up giving these workers the same amount of money as we would have given them in the weekly pay. But the difference is, we're letting them have their own real job, their own real income, and an enterprise they're going to work very hard to sustain because it's theirs. And because if it doesn't work, they can't go back and get more unemployment. They've had that. Italy is the country in Europe that has the most co-ops. Why? Because they gave them half a chance. Half a chance. Half a chance. And when with half a chance, they could do fine. Thank you. No problem. We here in the United States, could we do the same? Of course we could. We already have the precedent, don't we? We have a minority business administration. We have a small business administration. We already help all kinds of businesses get a leg up because we want them to be there. And why not a cooperative business administration? Why not have the government help? Why not let the American people thereby see co-op businesses all over the place where they could ask themselves the question, which do I prefer, to work in a top-down capitalist enterprise of the traditional sort or in a worker cooperative run democratically? Wow, Americans who like to talk about freedom of choice would finally have one in terms of how they work. What an interesting idea. Here's another thought. The next time a company comes to a union and says, we need concessions, you have to give us back holidays, you have to give us back an extra 20 minutes in the toilet every day. You have to give, because if you don't, we're leaving. Imagine a union that said to them, you're leaving. Have a nice trip. And let us tell you what's going to happen when you leave. We're going to get the local mayor to declare eminent domain. You can leave. Your machines, they stay here. So does your factory. And the day you move out, we, the workers who know exactly how to work these machines, we stay. And this becomes a worker co-op. And once you get up and running in Shanghai or Brazil, and you bring your products back here to sell to Americans, we'll be right behind you telling the American people, you can buy the goods from the company that abandoned the United States and went away, or you can buy from us the worker co-op that replaced them. Have a really nice day. And to the politician who says, I'm not going to do this, you explain to that politician very quickly, very politely, you either do this or your career is over. If you do this, you will have saved the jobs. You will have saved the community. You will have saved. And if you don't do it, you will have abetted the capitalist who abandoned us. You won't get elected to assistant deputy dog catcher when we're done. And for good reason. So you can get the politicians to enable what otherwise might not have happened. The ways forward here are not difficult. The number one problem for the American economy, as for this solution, is getting the American people, A, to understand how serious their situation is, and B, to recognize that there is an alternative way of organizing an economy that could do one heck of a better job dealing with this situation than the mumbling and bumbling and fumbling that's going on while the inequalities get worse, the job situation deteriorates, the debts of the students increase, and we all worry about global warming. The economics of this are not complicated. This is a political, ideological, philosophical question of when, and I no longer think whether. That's why I told you at the beginning what my speaking engagement is. So I'm not any more concerned about whether. It's only a question of when the United States will be able to begin to make the thinking, the actions, the unifying with others, overcoming the trauma of what happened to us as a nation after World War II, so that we can begin to make the shifts and changes that are happening in places like Greece. Last thing. In Greece, because many of you asked me to speak about it, Greece for many, many years had a political system like ours. They had two parties. One kind of like the Republican Party, called the New Democracy, and one kind of like the Democratic Party, but called in Greece the Greek Socialist Party, or PASOK. And they exchange, you know, every few years, one guy from one party was a prime minister, and then, like we do with Republicans and Democrats. So after a while, it becomes kind of hard sometimes to tell. Anyway, that's how the Greeks did it. And the two parties together got two-thirds to three-quarters of the vote. They never got the kinds of dominance that the Republicans and Democrats do, because the Europeans have a very peculiar idea. They want choice in politics. We, of course, know better. We don't need that. We just need two. But for them, they have a lot of parties. I've tried to explain to my European friends that we don't need that kind of choice. We know where choice matters. When you go into that supermarket, you want 27 kinds of breakfast cereal. You want choice. You want a lot of toothpaste, a lot of different car names. But when it comes to political party, two's fine. Two's fine. No need for that. Okay? In Europe, they don't think like that. They'll forego the toothpaste and the cereal. They want the political choice. So the Greeks always had some. We didn't. They did. In the last two elections, the two parties that were the dominant parties together can't get a third of the vote. The people of Greece abandoned their two parties and voted for a far left-wing party and swept them into office. Why in the world should Americans not understand that that can happen here too? Thank you very much.
Rick, I wanted to ask you about both Italy and Mondragon. Did those two places where they had co-ops find it necessary to develop a political presence, like either a political party, start their own party? Did they think that was important to do? And part of this question is also, do you think that... in this country, there could be a relationship between the co-ops in this country and any kind of political force or movement.
Yeah, Mondragon did not have a political party, and they have never been involved as an organized group in politics. Although most of them are leftists, They'd never thought of doing a party, and probably that was because when they formed, it was during Franco's years. So they've kind of stayed with that idea. Italy, I think, is different. I'll let him talk about that.
Very quickly, Italy didn't work with a specific political party. But for those of you who don't know it, because it's so different from the United States, Italy, like most European countries, has a deeply politicized culture. People know what party they're connected to, even if they don't participate in it. They have a sense of being a socialist or a communist or a fascist or whatever your orientation may be, so that the political realities of life are discussed a lot of the time. Most of my life here in the United States, if you're together with people over dinner, you avoid talking about politics because it's somehow bad taste. It's like saying an off-color joke that no one finds funny. They just find you tasteless for having done that. So politics is avoided as if it were. So in most European environments, including those of my family, my mother was German, my father French, so in those two cultures I'm close to, talking about politics, it would be bizarre to have a dinner that didn't include a lot of discussion, including lots of disagreement. It's part of the reason you could never vent the anti-communism in Europe that you did here. The reason in Italy, for example, is very simple. There's no Italian family that doesn't have a communist in it. Aunt Louise, who prepares the picnics, she's one. And if Aunt Louise, who makes those really good sandwiches, is a communist, how bad can it be? So it's very hard. Here in the United States, it was much easier because it was a phantom. Most people didn't know what it was, so you could describe or ascribe almost anything. What is interesting, though, is that even though the co-ops often got going without an explicit political link, when a political movement develops that is close to and supportive, then they're getting together. Spain is now the great example because the Podemos movement, which is trying to do in Spain what the Syriza party did in Greece, and there will be an election in December of this year in Spain that I would urge you to watch because it could be already be the second Greece. Their relationships between Pablo Iglesias, the head of the Podemos, and the Mondragon people is already underway.
I wanted to say something about Italy. When you mentioned that, we had a panel speaking for a Praxis event with some of the worker owners of the local cooperatives in the Bay Area. And one of them was talking about how they had loans, they were able to get loans for cooperatives in Italy. And so a question was, well, how come they're able to get loans for cooperatives there and we aren't? What do they have there? And they just answered, well, the bankers are all communists there.
Another reality, just simply, because it helps you understand the difference. In most European countries, banking is not an exclusively private enterprise. Most of the banking in Germany, for example, is public. These are publicly chartered banks. It's a little bit like the Bank of North Dakota in the United States, which is a publicly owned and operated bank by the state of North Dakota. Luckily, you here in California are not burdened with a public bank, but the folks in North Dakota, known for their political radicalism, have had a public bank for 100 years that no Republican and no Democratic politician dares question, let alone attack. So it just shows you, if you have an institution that's public and that serves the people, it can survive even in the most inhospitable of environments.
My question is, what role, in your opinion, if any, is played in this rapacious thing called capitalism that has failed by the fact that we have a monetary system, which Marco Vangelisti calls the operating system of capitalism, which itself is unsustainable and which causes scarcity and which is based on debt? Can you comment on that, please?
Sure. The monetary system of the United States, and indeed of most capitalist countries, is a wonderful microcosm of how this system organizes itself. In most countries, when capitalism was developing, and that was true of this country too, it allowed money, the creation of money, to be done privately. in much of the early history of the United States as an independent country, if you traveled from one part of the United States to another, you had to exchange the money that was functioning in one part of America to deal in another part of America with the other money. Money was produced by local banks. Money was produced by local financial associations. And as the country grew and the capitalism was more successful, the people who were involved in the businesses didn't want to deal with this problem. It was clumsy, it was expensive, it introduced uncertainties about what money would be worth, and so they wanted to get rid of it. They wanted to create one money for the whole country. It's the equivalent in the 19th century, which is when this happened, to what the Europeans have been doing in the last 20 years when they've tried to create the euro out of the various different currencies that you had to navigate when you went from Italy to Spain or from France to Netherlands and so on. Okay. Once you set up one, then of course you can, and there were movements to give that to a private monetary association. But that was found to be too dangerous because the private would be captured by one or another of the groups in the economy who would use it as part of their competitive struggle against others who would be disadvantaged. And so it became a warfare and a truce was reached. Let's give this role to the government. Let's give the government an extraordinary power to control the money supply. This was not a socialist initiative. This was a capitalist initiative. So let me say that again. The powerful role of the government in the economy was something that capitalists wanted to have as a solution to problems they were encountering. Just like the bailout of the banks in 2008 and 2009 was something demanded of the government by the private sector. After 30 years of denouncing the government for being a burden on all of us and a problem and a profligate, the same leaders rushed to Washington begging this government they had denounced to save them. The only thing more stunning than that is the fact that the government immediately did what it was told to do by them. So we now have a financial system in which we give one authority. It's called, in most countries, the central bank, like the Bank of England or the Bank of France and so on. We can't call it that, the Bank of the United States, because of our peculiar history in the United States in the 19th century. So we created something with a different name, but it's our central bank. It's called the Federal Reserve System. And it's a carefully constructed institution, semi-independent of the government, heavily controlled by the biggest banks in the United States. And their job is to manage the monetary system in such a way as to keep the capitalist system going. That's their job. They do that sometimes well. They do it sometimes poorly. But that's their job. Their job is not to help average people or anything else like that. That's their function. And they, of course, reproduce and condition the very capitalist realities that I've been talking about. For example, in the last 6 years, basically, they've decided to keep the economy going by pumping a record amount of money into the system, literally creating vast amounts of money, putting them on the accounts of big banks, and hoping to keep the economy going in that way. This is very scary stuff. It's a sign of how desperate the situation is because they've never produced that much new money and injected it into the economy in that short a time in the history of the country. That's why when you hear we're in a recovery, stop. If we were in a recovery, you wouldn't need this historically unprecedented flooding. And it leads others to get nervous because they imagine to themselves, wow, if this enormously increased amount of money were to start being spent on goods and services, which it hasn't been, but if it actually were, it would drive up the price of goods and services very quickly because they can't be introduced as fast as there is money that might be looking to buy them. Then we would have an inflation, which is a very scary problem because it means that if you can't keep up with the inflation, you start being in serious trouble as the prices go up and your means of buying don't go up at the same rate. And people are afraid that what we've done to offset our sinking ship in the downturn since 2008 will then be followed by a period of time where we're going to have an inflation that beats the band, and we have no reason to be confident that the Federal Reserve, which proved incapable of foreseeing this crisis, incapable of keeping it short and shallow, incapable of solving the problem except by pumping vast amounts of money, it will not be much more successful in dealing with the inflation its very practices will have helped to create. And so those who follow this scratch their heads with worry about what? About an economy that is in such deep trouble as to be unable even to get out with these extreme sorts of measures. But you know, I say partly in jest, but partly true. If what I am explaining to you, which again, you already know most of this, if this is troubling, then you've understood. If it's too troubling, watch TV. It will calm you. It's better than Xanax. It is just going to tell you that recovery is right around the corner. In fact, it's already here. This mantra of recovery, besides being false, is also cruel. Because what it does in this country is it tells the mass of people there's a recovery. And so the mass of people say to themselves, but I'm not. My debts are, I'm scared. And then the next step is, there's something wrong with me. There's this thing called the recovery. I'm not participating. And then we're back to the meritocracy. We're back to the grades that I talked about. It's a torture of people to tell them that there's something going on that they know they're not participating in, because in our culture they'll blame themselves. That makes the fact that you're not participating in a recovery twice as bad, because you become a self-torturer. And this is something this culture is doing on a massive scale and is driving no small number of people over the edge of a situation that is already too difficult.
Okay, we're going to go to Max Kaiser because that's what time it is.
Yeah. Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto Warren Buffett everything else. Stacey.
Max, we're going to be speaking about debt pushers, oligarchs, and middlemen in this episode. And the first headline reads, Warren Buffett's mobile home empire preys on the poor. Billionaire profits at every step from building to selling to high-cost lending. This is Clayton Homes, and it's the nation's biggest home builder. They build 50% of new homes in America, and they're all mobile homes. You know, those things that you have delivered on the back of a truck, a lorry, and put onto some piece of property that you don't actually own somewhere. Well, Buffett's mobile home empire promises low-income Americans the dream of home ownership, but Clayton relies on predatory sales practices, exorbitant fees, and interest rates that can exceed 15%, trapping many buyers in loans they can't afford in homes that are almost impossible to sell or refinance, an investigation by the Center for Public.
Okay, just a minute, everybody. Whoops. Hold on. A glitch in the works. Here we go.
I'm now through the
exorbitant that can exceed 15%, trapping many buyers in loans they can't afford in homes that are almost impossible to sell or refinance, an investigation by the Center for Public Integrity and the Seattle Times has found.
Yeah, well, yeah, Warren Buffett's become the company store of America. You know, he's the guy people end up dealing with, whether they're eating junk food from junk food sellers, processed food. Of course, he owns huge amounts of processed foods. He owns railways to move all the processed food and coal and energy and oil and all that stuff from coast to coast. He's now into essentially the slumlord business. I kind of feel bad for Warren Buffett because I started following his career 30 years ago. And early on, you know, he used a Graham-Dodd valuation model, buying, you know, dollars for 50 cents, and he's a pretty respected guy. But at some point, you run out of companies to buy into where you are simply providing capital in a way that makes economic sense. And now in the last 10 years, he's really had to resort to slumlord business and junk food business. And he's really, him and Charlie Munger, his friend, have had to really kind of roll in the gutter now to pick up the change, and it's really sad to see.
So this is Clayton Homes, the biggest home builder in America. They build those mobile homes. His company, Berkshire Hathaway, bought the company in 2003. He's expanded it from a $1.3 billion, which he bought it at, to now a multi-billion-dollar company. That basically Clayton Homes uses other Berkshire Hathaway subsidiaries like painting and decorating, and Clayton Homes itself borrows money from Berkshire Hathaway in order to lend to these people at 15%. Of course, Berkshire Hathaway is one of the highest rated bonds in the world. They could issue debt at the lowest cost. In fact, they could get it for basically negative interest rates at the government. And they talk about that under federal guidelines, most Clayton loans are considered higher priced. Those loans average 7 percentage points higher than the typical home loan in 2013, according to the Center for Public Integrity Times analysis of federal data, compared with just 3.8 percentage points above for other lenders.
Right. If Warren Buffett were a politician in South Africa 20, 30 years ago, he would support apartheid, because this is interest rate apartheid. If you are not one of Warren's friends or shareholders and the shares are over $200,000 apiece, then you're going to pay through the nose an exorbitant rate for access to capital. If you're on the right side of the interest rate apartheid wall, and you're a friend of Charlie and Warren, then your cost of capital is near zero. And let's face it, this Berkshire Hathaway is not about competition. It's an anti-competitive conglomerate that if there was any regulator in America, they would not let this conglomeration of thieving and slumlording take place. But of course, the regulators are in the pockets of people in the crony capitalist class like Warren Buffett.
Well, they control 39% of the mobile home loan market. The next biggest competitor is Wells Fargo, which I think he's also a huge owner of.
He's a big owner. Remember that in 2008 when the financial system crashed, one of the biggest subsidiary recipients was Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway. Had he been forced to compete on a level playing field with other business people in America, we would be talking about him in the past and Berkshire Hathaway in the past as a company that unfortunately was not smart enough to survive the downturn. But because he got huge, billions, multi-billion dollar handout and subsidies from the federal government, he's alive, that the parasite of Berkshire Hathaway has been allowed to continue and to grow and to suck the lifeblood out of the American economy.
So Clayton owns 39% of the new mobile home loan market. Wells Fargo is the second biggest at 6%, just 6%. So they also maintain this cozy, this down home, shucks, we're just like regular folks sort of thing. They use the guy from the
Duck Dynasty.
Duck Dynasty.
Quack, quack, quack.
Yeah.
I am a quacker for Warren Buffett. Quack, quack, quack. Yeah, they're slumlord, monetization of the slums as well.
But it works because, there's a quote from here from a person who lives in Bug Tussle, Alabama.
Bug Tussle.
These bugs are tussling down in Alabama, and Carol has been paying down her home for more than a decade, but still owes nearly 90% of the sales price and more than twice what the home is worth. Because, of course, the value of these mobile homes are just like cars. You drive it off the lot, and it drops by 50%. In the meantime, these people have 20, 22, 26-year loans, up to 30-year loans on these properties. That the break-even point doesn't even come until, 21 years into these loans because of the high interest rates and the declining value of it.
Like anyone who's seen that movie, It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart at the SNL, who everyone loves. He goes against Mr. Potter, who's the corrupt banker in the evil center of town who turns the town into houses and whiskey joints. And this sounds like Bug Tussle is being turned in via Berkshire Hathaway, a slum of ill repute and drug use, thanks to Mr. Potter / Warren Buffett.
Well, Warren Buffett himself and Berkshire Hathaway actually issued a letter after this article to deny any of this. And they say they give people the ability to own their own property sort of thing. So they're denying
it. Well, you get 40 acres and a mule. Yeah, we give them all the chains they need to wrap around their necks and jump in the pond and drown. Because at a good price, at a good rate, because we love you at Berkshire Hathaway.
So another interesting thing along this sort of line of why Americans are sinking deeper and deeper into poverty is the real reason.
Yeah, why is that? If things are so great, yeah. And Warren Buffett can buy all these great businesses, and the money's easy, and America's fabulous, why is the poverty rate skyrocketing?
Well, exactly. Well, because there's a lot of middlemen, and there are many administrators in this so-called capitalist system. And we turn to the headline, the real reason college tuition costs so much. A major factor driving increase in costs is the constant expansion of university administration. According to the Department of Education data, administrative positions at colleges and universities grew by 60% between 1993 and 2009, which Bloomberg reported was 10 times the rate of growth of tenured faculty positions. So you have in California, there was a 221% increase in the number of administrators, and they're on huge salaries compared to the tenured faculty salaries, which were declining.
I'll give you another country that died because there were too many bureaucrats, civil servants, and administrators. The Soviet Union.
Yeah, exactly.
So America is becoming Sovietization by giving money to bureaucrats.
There's too many bureaucrats, but there's also a toll booth. Like Warren Buffett is a toll booth operator. Every single aspect of the mobile home market of people already so impoverished working at McDonald's and chefs and short order chefs.
That's for slave wages.
Yeah, but he's taking a cut at every single.
Right. He's
angle.
The company store. Remember
he's
on the plantation
yeah.
In the antebellum South of America, there were the slaves. And they had to shop at the company store, which was owned by the slave owner. So here's Warren Buffett, slave owner of the 21st century. He owns Berkshire Hathaway, the company store. He puts people up in these slums. And if they got to buy toothpaste, toothbrush, a biscuit, you know, a condom, a big shaver,
Heinz
a shaver,
ketchup,
a ketchup, right?
Kraft macaroni and cheese
Yeah, here's
dinner.
Warren Buffett should have a cookbook, how to make some lovely tomato soup for your family. Take a little Heinz ketchup packet from one of the restaurants he owns and put it into some hot boiling water and maybe, you know, shoot a frog or whatever they have in Bug Tussle, get some bugs, you know, put it in your ketchup soup. And it's a Warren stew, Warren Buffett stew. Warren loves us.
Actually, on that Warren Buffett story, a lot of people are in default on their mortgage loans on these mobile homes.
Well, they're going to Warren Buffett's own prisons.
Exactly. But apparently the debt collectors are telling them, encouraging them not to buy medicine, not to buy food that week and things like that. But finally, I want to talk about another story along this sort of debt market and toll booths everywhere. Is it emerged this past week that the IMF has made a 2.5 billion euro profit on Greek debt and the Greek misery and Greek austerity and the Greek disaster? Well, here we have odious debt has finally arrived, Greece, to write off illegal debt. So Zoe Konstantopoulou, and I hope I pronounced his name right, the head of the Greek parliament.
And Konstantopoulou.
And he released two videos, which promptly went viral. And I'll show you a little clip here, because that clip, that text there says, check it, erase it. And that is referring to 320 billion euro debt. The people of Greece want to check it, that it's not odious. And, of course, they're going to find it's odious and then write it off.
No, you can't assume that they will automatically find it to be odious. Obviously, all the debt that was illegally incurred through the malfeasance and market securities law violations of Goldman Sachs and John Paulson and Papandreou, the former prime minister, who colluded to defraud the Greek people as they were fraudulently induced to join the euro.
Well, there's a debt truth committee. They formed a debt truth committee.
Again, like apartheid.
They're going to look at it. Yeah, exactly, like apartheid. They're going to examine it and find out which is illegal, which was given odiously, like with a predatory loan, as we're talking at the beginning of the show, is if you're giving a loan to somebody that you know cannot pay this back, that's considered odious debt, it's considered a predatory loan, it's considered illegal. You can't coerce somebody into taking something that they can't afford to pay. So they want to look at whether or not this debt bailout, the IMF, the Troika, all of that loans that they gave during the crisis, whether they knew that, in fact, Greece could never pay that back. Obviously, they did know because it's 180% of their GDP.
Any debt that tastes worse than moussaka is odious and should be made illegal and written off. That's the Max Kaiser debt jubilee methodology. Odious debt, moussaka. Which tastes better? Moussaka? Then this is clearly garbage debt. It's illegal. It's odious. Get rid of it. Follow my advice, Greece.
The problem with your tests is that everything tastes better with ouzo.
Thanks, Stacy. All right, well, stay tuned for the second half. A whole lot more. Welcome back to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Time now to turn to internet and tech pioneer Halsey Miner. Among many things, Halsey founded CNET and co-founded Salesforce.com. Halsey's latest venture is BitReserved, a next-generation money service built on top of Bitcoin. Halsey, welcome to the Kaiser Report.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So let me kind of lay out a scenario.
Okay.
I can send dollars, pounds, yen, gold, silver, platinum, palladium, like email, on the internet. I don't touch a bank. It's instantaneous, and my fees are almost zero. Is that true? Is that correct?
It's true, and the banks say with $20 or $30 billion and 5 more years, they can do the same thing. But yes, it's today you can actually exchange significant forms of value, four metals and then six of the biggest currencies instantaneously and at no cost.
Because
and that's the value of the cloud.
A friend of mine, I was sending him some cash and from a bank, and this just happened. And he's saying, well, you need the IBAN number, you need the routing number.
Right.
He said, well, this bank doesn't have it. It's a small bank. Another day went by. So just moving money around the world, Forex, foreign exchange, money in this way, it's time-consuming, it's costly, and so BitReserve is as easy as sending an email. I can send anybody any these currencies and commodities. It just completely bypasses the banking infrastructure completely and entirely. Now, the way this happens, the way this comes off, the reason you can do this is there's an on-ramp.
Correct.
To get to this magical utopian place
exactly.
Where banks are all...
Yeah, that's right.
And that on-ramp is called Bitcoin.
Today, it's Bitcoin. That's
right?
Correct. That's
so
correct.
Bitcoin allows you to...
That's right.
So you're using Bitcoin, you know, from what I gather, you don't really care much about Bitcoin other than the fact that it gets people to a place where they can do what you're doing here, which is fantastic.
I've started cloud-based businesses in lots of different industries and have funded some. So the first Forpay music service, Rhapsody, I was the initial investor. So I've used the cloud to make telecom simple, cheap, free, easy to use, which is called Google Voice. CNET, we made content free and ubiquitous. So the cloud solves many, many problems of connecting lots of people or organizations and doing things very low cost and allowing for innovation. The problem was that there was no way to get value before Bitcoin. So I could build my cloud-based system, but I couldn't put anything in it. And of course, the banks wouldn't connect to you because why would the bank connect to somebody who's instant, free, transparent, and hasn't, you know, and allows people to innovate? But what happened was this sort of magic. The real magic was the innovation of Bitcoin, and in a way, it created gold. It created alchemy. Some of this stuff that wasn't here today and now has a significant amount of value.
All right. So in 2009, the white paper is published. Satoshi Nakamoto comes out with Bitcoin, the protocol, and this is a bit of magic. So you're an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
You've created startups. You've been co-founding startups. Salesforce.com. You put all that, the work of the salesman in the cloud, essentially,
right.
And it became a multi-billion dollar company. So you look at this piece of magic, this code, this software, and you just recognize instantly as an entrepreneur that this is the magic missing piece to something, a problem that you have been mulling about for quite some time, which is how to send value over the internet instantaneously in a way like this.
Correct. But there's another piece to it. The part of the reason the banks are the way they are is because they want to be that way. And the other part is because they have systems that are very old. And so what Salesforce did is it took this software that was in these companies that was old and didn't work very well and was incredibly expensive, and it replaced it with cloud-based software. And that's why they're a $50 billion company today, was because this old software inside of companies, Salesforce offered the vision of running cloud-based software for a fraction of the cost with way more innovation. Well, as it turns out, the same thesis applies to banks. Banks are running, old software that, has been around for, millennia. And And they have no ability to innovate on top of it, but they also don't have an interest in innovating. The difference with Salesforce went to companies who wanted to innovate, but they couldn't because of their software. And so Salesforce offered the opportunities for companies, new and old, to basically start again and build new infrastructure. And we're basically creating a new banking system, monetary system, really, from the ground up with new software.
Now, Halsey, one of the interesting points here is that, you know, you talk about the cumbersome nature of the banking industry, the entrenched oligopoly, the fees, the, you know, the tendency toward larceny, as I would describe it, within the banks. And it's, it even gets even more ludicrous when talking about things like gold and silver, which have been money for thousands of years. And with BitReserve, am I correct in saying that I can send gold as easily?
Yes, and instantaneously and free. And it's, again, because...
But doesn't that mean that gold can then reemerge as a currency?
The beauty of what we do is we let everybody choose the form of value that feels most comfortable to them. And so economists have suggested gold, and some have suggested Bitcoin, and some have said the dollar is right. And our whole thesis as a company is we're not going to dictate to you what should be your form of monetary value. We're going to let you use, you know, 10 now and... You know, I have to think by the end of the year of 100 plus forms of value that you can, you know, typically currencies that you can hold whatever feels non-volatile to you or whatever you want. So we can resolve these academic debates because we'll see what people pick. People have a choice. And so, you know, when I first looked at this business, the Bitcoin to me seemed volatile. And I thought there were a lot of people who wouldn't want to hold it because of this volatility. And so that really led to, well, how do I give dollars, euros, and even gold the same benefit of Bitcoin, sort of this instantaneous transactability, but do it to other forms of monetary value and let the consumer pick what feels most comfortable for them.
The biggest market in the world by far is oil. Now, with every barrel of oil, there's something like $60,000 worth of derivatives that go with that barrel of oil. And there's an enormous middleman. It's an enormous political hot potato and creates wars and all things are happening. On BitReserve, if I get this correctly, you're saying that you essentially could put oil on the blockchain and I could send oil as easily as I send email and it would completely transform the biggest market in the world. Is that true?
So the only product that we've announced that we announced was coming was oil. And we announced that it would come in 2015. And the reason we did that is because it's actually very hard to do it. Nobody's actually been able to. So most of the people who use oil as money or hedge it, they're all using sophisticated Wall Street trading systems, which is not appropriate for either us or the people that we're building products for. So what we did was we brought a whole bunch of partners in that we're now working with, because the idea is to create a form of value that rises and falls specifically with the value of oil. And again, it's to let people choose to take volatility out of their life. So if you're a truck driver or you're in a business like trucking, transportation that has big component that's related to the price of oil, you can just put money on the oil card and it will rise and fall with the price of oil. And so, you know, a sophisticated strategy of hedging on Wall Street or here in London becomes something that your truck driver can go and can do himself through our card. But we're an innovative company and it's an innovation within an innovation. I think we will have it out by the end of the year and hopefully prices will still be low.
So obviously all the intermediaries, the bankers and the traders, of course, they would feel pressured by this. So is there going to be any kind of a major legal pushback? I know that in the music industry, in the recording industry, when P2P file swapping came around for videos and music, the MPAA and the RIAA, they were quite active. They, you know, arrested Kim.com in New Zealand with a SWAT team, you know, for the exercising his constitutional rights. Aaron Swartz is a pioneer who was essentially chased to death. Okay, now, you're kind of in that pioneer league of innovators. I don't want to put you exactly on that in plateau because then they'd come after you and Chris Dodd would try to kill you like he did Aaron Schwartz. But, you know,
interesting is what we're actually doing are really two things. The first is we're creating more demand. So instead of buying oil that is going to be produced, we're buying oil that's going to be held as monetary value, like gold is held today. So the gold that's held today that people own, it isn't being turned into jewelry, it's being held. And so the oil, same would apply to oil. And today, anytime you can create another buyer of oil, they're very happy. And when it comes to the government,
wait a minute, let me jump in, because they're not very happy because the intermediaries love to take their fat fees. I mean, the markets are not driven by supply and demand. The markets are driven by intermediaries taking big fat fees, and you're interrupting that. So you're putting yourself on the front line of some very powerful people. Now, I think it's fantastic, and I would love to see all the bankers disappear because I think they're a negative influence on the economy. But, you know, are you... I mean, this is fantastic. That's all I can say. But I mean, it seems like you're taking on the most powerful shysters in the world. Are you ready for this?
You know, my experience has been when competing with existing industries that until they actually start feeling it financially, they don't really take it that seriously. And so I think for most of the things that we're doing today, my guess is that most of the big banks and other organizations are not really taking any of this very seriously.
Okay, but they will, like they did with P2P file swapping.
They absolutely will. Let's talk about
Mexico. Okay, Ricardo Salinas, who we interviewed on our show recently. We were down in Mexico City. A very nice fella down there. It's great. You've already doing some big deals down there. We've got about a minute left. Can you speak on that a little bit?
Yeah, no. Ricardo is incredibly visionary. He's an amazing entrepreneur, and that is really our prototype. So you will be able to, the largest Electro, which he owns, which is the largest retailer, they will be accepting BitReserve first through their website, then through the stores. But at the same time, working with Banco Azteca, and Electra, I will be able to send money through BitReserve to somebody down in Mexico, and they'll be able to go to one of 1,600 Electra stores and get that money for a fraction of the cost of remittance today. It's about a $30 billion remittance market, money moving from the U.S. down to Mexico. And they'll be able to use, if I send the money to somebody down there, instead of remitting it, they actually buy at his store, what will happen is because all those movements are free, the cost of money for the person goes from 10% to zero, and for bro, there's no Visa.
Right, the remittance market to Mexico is the biggest in the world. We're out of time, Halsey. Okay. Thanks so much for being on the Kaiser Report.
Thanks, pleasure.
All right, and that's going to do it for this edition of the Kaiser Report with me, Max Kaiser, and Stacey Herbert. I'd like to thank our guest, Halsey Miner, founder and CEO of BitReserve. If you'd like to get in touch, tweet us at Kaiser Report. Until next time, bye, y'all.
Okay, we're going to play a real quick piece on Bernie Schechter. You know, he made his Danny Schechter, excuse me. He made his transition some weeks ago, March 20th. Oh, dear. But anyway, we just got to honor him a little bit. So let's play the little piece here. Here we go.
Well, we end the show remembering the author, filmmaker, and media reform activist Danny Schechter, who has died of pancreatic cancer at the age of 72. Danny rose to prominence as the news dissector on Boston's WBCN radio in the 1970s. He went on to work as a television producer at ABC's 2020, where he won two Emmy Awards, and at the newly launched CNN. But he left corporate media to lead MediaChannel.org and Global Vision.
Danny Schechter wrote 12 books, including The More You Watch, The Less You Know, and was a leading activist and journalist against apartheid in South Africa, making six nonfiction films about Nelson Mandela. Danny was a frequent guest on Democracy Now! Juan and I spoke to him in 2013 after the passing of Nelson Mandela.
Well, you know, I had the fortune of being at the London School of Economics in the 60s at the right place at the right time, where the ANC people had come into exile. And in my class was a remarkable woman, Ruth First, who became sort of my mentor about South Africa. And I was recruited by the ANC to go into South Africa. They couldn't get their people in because so many of them were in prison and well known to the security police. So people from England would then called the London Recruits, were sent into South Africa on various missions. I was one of them, naive perhaps to do this, unaware really of the consequences that awaited me if I was caught. But I went anyway as an act of solidarity. I went to the funeral of the late Chief Luthuli, who was the leader of the ANC before Mandela. And I, you know, got an insight into how vicious the apartheid system was, how pervasive it was in people's lives. It wasn't just about race. It was about controlling people as labor, as a labor force in South Africa. This was always about economics, not just pigmen. And Americans make the mistake of, you know, confusing what was happening in South Africa with the civil rights movement in America, where people fought to have the Constitution apply to them. In South Africa, there was no Constitution, and there were no rights for a majority, not a minority, of people. And so I experienced that up front and personally, in a way. But it also got me involved deeply in South Africa. And then years later, not only did I write about South Africa and was one of the organizers of the Africa Research Group in Boston, but I became active in a project called Sun City, Artists Against Apartheid. And, you know, just to supplement what Randall Robinson told you earlier, this was not all about lobbying Congress. This was about informing America about what was happening. And in some cases, it was cultural figures, 58 of the world's top artists who indicted the system of forced relocation in South Africa. That's what Sun City was all about. It was a part of an effort to promote a cultural boycott alongside an economic boycott. And it was very successful and worldwide in its impact. And I think that was important. And then, I helped start the TV series South Africa Now that ran for 156 weeks every week in the United States, reporting on South Africa through the eyes of South Africans. It was their story.
On PBS.
And it was on public television stations. PBS never really officially supported it, but many stations did. It was also on in 40 countries around the world throughout Southern Africa. So it actually had a tremendous impact of bringing the message of the democratic movement to a world audience. And I think that was very critical. And then, of course, the documentaries. And most recently, I was in South Africa documenting the making and the meaning of this new movie, Mandela Long Walk to Freedom. And that movie will be in 2,000 cinemas in America starting Christmas Day. It's a very dramatized, but important film about Mandela in the way that the movie Gandhi was about Gandhi, but it leaves a lot out. And that's why the producers of the movie asked me to write this book, Madiba, A to Z, The Many Faces of Nelson Mandela, to talk about the rest of the story. And I did so by interviewing over 150 people who work with Mandela, who are part of this whole struggle. And what I got from them was not only admiration for him, but also a perspective that this was not just one man, but a movement that pulled this off, this change. And it was a movement that was organized in a democratic manner from the bottom up, not the top down. So, you know, even though we revere and admire Mandela, we have to also pay respect to the people of South Africa who suffered all these years, you know, torture, imprisonment, death, fighting apartheid.
That was Danny Schechter, the news dissector. He was joining us in 2013. He's died of pancreatic cancer. You can watch the rest of that interview as well as all of his appearances on Democracy Now! At democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berker, Nick Elsar, Amato, Nirmin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sanaa Kapani Masood, Ravi Karan, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website is democracynow.org. Special thanks to Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Charlie Roberts. Thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, now we're going to do a little, just one section of Black Girls Rock from last Sunday. Very interesting.
Ms. Deborah Lee.
Good evening. Black Girls Rock is more than an award show. It is a monumental movement that empowers girls and represents the truth, beauty, and strength of Black womanhood. Congratulations to all of the inspiring, trailblazing women we are celebrating tonight. I am also proud to say that I have been a firsthand witness to the wonderful work that Beverly Bond and Black Girls Rock have done to empower girls through arts, education, leadership development, and other enrichment programs.
to thank Beverly Vaughn for listening to that little voice.
Every generation, someone articulates the mantra that needs to be said to lift people up.
Can you say Black Girls Rock?
Beverly had Black Girls Rock, I think, in her DNA. Watching her have the courage to make her vision come alive, that's really the mark of a revolutionary and of a visionary. It's sad that when we are talking about how Black Lives Matter, when you tune into media, the messages don't reflect the revolution that's going on.
Black Girls Rock is absolutely necessary so that we actually become co-creators in the images that are presented of us. I am amazed at the brilliance of the young women at this camp. They are talking about what's going on in the media. They're talking about messages and music. They're learning music, and they're from all over the world.
Of self-esteem that does come from BGR helped me validate my existence.
I made 30 sisters. I heard some speakers talk about things that I've been meaning to hear, and I got to be with ladies of color that understood me.
Black Girls Rock, it's allowing us to be all that we are and all of our layers and all of our complexities. We know that if we empower Black women, the whole country lifts up.
Ladies and gentlemen, the founder, CEO, and executive producer of Black Girls Rock, Beverly Vaughn.
Thank you. I'm Beverly Vaughn, and I am a Black girl who rocks. I want to congratulate all of tonight's incredible celebrants who represent the spectrum of brilliance that Black women possess. Your elevation in our culture matters because far too often the breadth and depth of contributions made by Black women are pushed outside the margins of mainstream culture. In result, young Black girls do not always get to see diverse, layered, and healthy representations of role models to emulate. I started Black Girls Rock to create a space where Black women and Black girls could proclaim our identities boldly and unapologetically. Black Girls Rock is not just an ornamental phrase used to cloak ourselves in vanity. It is a critical and necessary affirmation. Because when you grow up Black and a girl, you come to recognize that there is a privilege associated with race and gender. And as a Black girl, you learn that because of the skin and the body that you were born in, society has placed you at the bottom of this hierarchy. So saying that we rock is a response to the tremendous neglect that Black girls feel when they grow up in a society where they are underrepresented, misrepresented, or completely overlooked. When girls tune into Black Girls Rock on BET, they get the message that Black girls matter. They see phenomenal women who look like them rocking out and calling shots. Speaking of extraordinary women, one of my favorite role models, change makers, and shot callers is here with us tonight, and I have the honor of introducing her. She is definitely a Black girl who rocks. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the Black Girls Rock stage, First Lady of the United States of America, Michelle Obama.
First of all, thank you so much to Beverly, to my dear friend Deborah. Look, I am so excited to be here at Black Girls Rock. Oh.
here tonight and all across the country. Let me say those words again. Black girls rock. We rock. We rock. No matter who you are, no matter where you come from, you are beautiful. You are powerful. You are brilliant. You are funny. Let me tell you, I am so proud of you. My husband, your president, is so proud of you. And we have such big hopes and dreams for every single one of you. Now, I know that's not always the message that you get from the world. I know there are voices that tell you that you're not good enough, that you have to look a certain way, act a certain way, that if you speak up, you're too loud. If you step up to lead, you're being bossy. You see, when I was a girl, I had parents who loved me and believed in me, but those doubts still worked their way inside my head and my heart. And I was always worried about something. Does my hair look right? Am I too tall? Do I raise my hand too much in class? So when folks said that a girl like me shouldn't aspire to go to the very best colleges in this country, I thought maybe they're right. But eventually I learned that each of those doubts was like a little test. A challenge that either I could shrink away from or rise up to meet. And I decided to rise. Yes. I decided to rewrite those tired old scripts that define too many of us. I decided that I wasn't bossy. I was confident and strong. And loud, I was a young woman with something important to say. And when I looked into the mirror, I saw a tall and smart and beautiful black girl. And that, more than anything else, is what I want all of you to know. I want that for you. I want you to live life on your own terms. According to your own script. I want you to use those tests in your lives today to make you stronger for the bigger challenges tomorrow. Because trust me, those challenges will come. No one just glides their way from success to success. Not me, not the president, not anyone being honored here tonight. Anyone who has achieved anything in life knows that challenges and failures are necessary components of success. They know that when things get hard, that's not always a sign that you're doing something wrong. It's often a sign that you're doing something right. Because those hard times are what shape you into the person you're meant to be. And tonight, we've got three young women here who are living, breathing examples of that fundamental truth. So let's welcome back to the stage this year's Mad Girls, Kaya Thomas, Chantal Song Bembry, and Gabrielle Jordan. I am so proud of these young women. Leading, for the lives they are transforming in their communities. But let me tell you something. I am sure that in the process of achieving all that they've achieved, that they have faced plenty of obstacles. I am sure that they heard plenty of voices telling them that their dreams were too big or too hard or not the right kind of dreams for girls like them. See, but these girls didn't listen to those voices. They listened to their own voices.
They held fast to their own dreams, and most importantly, they prepared themselves to achieve those dreams by working hard in school and getting their education. So, one message that I want to leave you with tonight is this. The secret to everything in life, every aspiration, every opportunity, is education. It's education. There is nothing more important than being serious about your education. That's the reason I am able to stand here tonight. Because, look, I worked hard in school. Education was cool for me. I did my best on every paper, every test, every homework assignment. And I want every single one of our black girls to do the same, and our black boys. I want them to do that all the way through high school, then college, and then beyond. I want you to work as hard as you can, learn as much as you can. That is how you will go from being black girls who rock to being black women who rock. That is how you will unleash the genius and the power and the passion required to rock your communities, to rock our country, to rock this world. I love you all. I believe in you all. And I'm confident that you all will shine brightly, lighting the way for generations of girls to come. Thank you all. God bless.
We got our guest, Jean Bauer, author of Living the Farm Sanctuary Life. You're going to want to get this book. You know, not right now, obviously. We're still doing a show. But at the end, you're going to want to get this book. Once you obviously turn off the NCAA championship. Oh, when you watch this on DVR, you're going to want to get the book. And obviously, we're going to talk about the elephant in the room, the big news that I'm sure you all heard from last week. Seth Rollins won the WWE World Championship. My nemesis. Respect, though, to Seth. That was a shrewd movie pulled, and I appreciate that. Also, they have hired a new Daily Show host. Mr. Trevor Noah is going to be hosting the show, and I'm very excited about it. And I will say, I know there was a large kerfuffle on Twitter. But I can say this, I think, without hesitation. Trevor Noah will earn your trust and respect, or not. Just as I earned your trust and respect, or did not. Or sometimes earned it, and then lost it, and then kind of got it back, but then it was like, that guy, and then it was, oh, that rally was so stupid, I'm never going, oh, I hate him! Like, it kind of just goes that way. The only thing I would say is, I do hope you give him an opportunity to earn that trust and respect, because my experience with him is that he is an incredibly thoughtful and considerate and funny and smart individual. And man, I think you give him that time and it's going to be well worth it. I'm excited for where he's going to take this thing. I'm going to watch. I'm going to set my DVR to finally, after 17 years, I'm going to record The Daily Show when he takes over. But no, that's not the only thing. There's a lot of stuff. There's a Ron happening, all these things. And this happened last week.
Indiana's Governor Mike Pence, surrounded by nuns, Franciscan monks, and Orthodox Jews, signed something called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act into law.
Supporters say it protects a person or business owner from government persecution when following their religious beliefs.
Here. I didn't realize that people in Indiana could not practice religion. I'm excited. I thought you could practice religion in Indiana, but apparently it has up to now been illegal. One of those quirky local laws, I guess. But Well, God bless. All's well that ends well.
Critics say it's a thinly veiled disguise for discrimination against gay people, essentially allowing businesses to deny them services for religious reasons.
What the Wait, denying gay people for religious... Gay people aren't asking you to make them a gay product. They're just asking to buy the product you make. Although perhaps that explains the signs in so many Indiana storefronts. I can't imagine Indiana would get away with this type of discrimination.
Even the NCAA is coming out against the measure just days before the state's capital city hosts the men's basketball championships.
That's got to hurt. When you're being criticized by a company whose entire business model is based on exploitation. Oh, you can't discriminate against gays. You can profit on their likeness without compensation. Here's how you can get away with it. Just call them student gays. And by the way, if you're thinking, well, who needs the NCAA anyway? Not us in Indiana. Well, that's when the big guns came out.
Angie's List CEO says the company's expansion project in Indianapolis is on hold.
It just got real. Without Angie's List, how are you going to find a trustworthy contractor to remodel your house? Craigslist is no good. They'll just dress your house up as a furry and rub themselves on it. You want that. That just resonated way too hot. The point is, the backlash was so intense, Indiana Governor Mike Pence had no choice but to respond very stupidly.
Do you think it should be legal in the state of Indiana to discriminate against gays or lesbians?
George,
it's a yes or no question.
Come on. Hoosiers don't believe in discrimination. There are no kinder, more generous, more welcoming, more hospitable people in America than in the 92 counties of Indiana.
But first of all, can we stop talking about the people of Indiana like they're a lost tribe from Nostalgistan? The good people of Indiana, the motto is please and thank you, and the currency of Indiana is a homemade lemon square. Let's face it, people from Indiana are no nicer or here than people anywhere else, except Philly. That's the worst. And D.C. It's any NL East city. Mets rule! Wait, what are we talking about again? Oh, Indiana. Anyway, it seems like Governor Mike Pence's unwavering belief in the goodness of Hoosiers did need some tweaking.
Mike Pence approving changes to a controversial new law.
The new language in Indiana spells out that the law does not authorize a provider to refuse to offer or provide services on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity.
Anymore. Because it's the right thing to do. And you caught us. You know, I'd like to believe that the change in language came via a moral epiphany, but my guess is it's more of a, and I would have gotten away with it too if it weren't for you meddling kids.
The reason that those corporations put the pressure on Indiana and Arkansas was because the militant gay community put the pressure on them.
Shut up! So when gays want equality, it's militancy. And when Christians want to deny service, it's freedom. See, those who are defending this sort of law go very far out of their way to say how it's not discriminatory towards anybody, especially gay people. They've got nothing against gay people. And they use analogies to clarify their position, which the analogies do. Just not in the way they intended.
If you're a print shop and you are a gay man, should you be forced to print God hates fags for the Westboro Baptist Church?
If a KKK member comes in and says, I want a birthday cake made to celebrate the birth of the KKK, should a baker, regardless of the color of their skin, be able to say, I am not going to make that cake?
I would think I would give the same right to a Jewish baker to not have to put a swastika on a bill.
It's been a while since I've taken the SATs. But I believe the formulation as you defend yourselves is this. This couple is to Christian business as these folks are to everyone else. Is that what you're saying? I'm not discriminating. I have nothing against gay people. I'm just saying, for some Christians, catering an elderly lesbian wedding is like making a Jew slow dance with Hitler. That's all I'm saying. Do you see how f***ed up that is? Basically, you see people celebrating love as a hate group. Although, there is good news.
It remains legal in most of Indiana to fire someone because they're gay.
Yes. So the lesson here is clear. If you're in Indiana and you get fired for being gay, make those motherfuckers cater your wedding. We'll be right back. The Farm Sanctuary Life, the ultimate guide to eating mindfully, living longer, and feeling better every day. Please welcome to the program, Mr. Gene Bauer. Sir.
I'm
delighted to see you here. You guys do incredible work. But before we get into the whole thing on Living the Farm Sanctuary Life, the book, explain just very briefly, what is Farm Sanctuary?
Farm Sanctuary is an organization that works to protect farm animals from the cruelty of factory farming. Mm-hmm. We operate sanctuaries where the animals get to live out their lives. And these are animals that have literally been thrown in trash cans or on piles of dead animals. And so we just take care of them. They're our friends, not our food. And we encourage people just to think about the way we live and eat and to make more mindful choices.
It's harder to eat meat when you know the animal's name.
So
I
true.
Have found.
So true. Yeah.
Because look, on the one side, this eating mindfully and vegan seems to be the solution to nutrition, to health, to global warming.
Yes, absolutely.
On the other side, corned beef.
Well, there's habits.
How do we bridge that gap?
Well, there are now meatless meats that can taste a lot like corned beef. And yeah, they can.
All right.
Yeah, they're getting better every year. And it's getting easier and easier than it's ever been. And there are actually companies that have been set up to create plant-based meats that have a very similar mouthfeel, a similar texture and taste. And
can I get...
But you can also eat beans. You don't need to eat that stuff either.
Because if I were to get this, will an old Jewish man yell at me while I eat it, though? That's really... That's the corned beef experience I would miss.
Yeah, that can happen. That can happen.
Right. You know, it's interesting. So the Dietary Council just released, I mean, on the heels of this book, that this vegan lifestyle is sort of the solution to... So many of the issues that are going on in the world.
We could save 70% on healthcare costs if we shifted to a whole foods plant-based diet in this country.
Right.
We could save so much in terms of resources, water, for example. Half of the water used in this country is used to raise animals for food.
Right.
So shifting away from eating animals and eating plants would put a much lighter footprint on the planet. Global warming is a whole other thing, climate change. Animal agriculture contributes more to climate change than the entire transportation industry. So, you know, just by shifting to eating plants, we can have enormous impacts, you know, on animals, on the planet, and on our own well-being. You know,
here's what I love about this book, though. It's not, you know, I think sometimes those who have adopted this lifestyle can sometimes get a little sanctimonious, or sometimes like
a passionate group,
for sure. Very passionate, but can really give you the once over, if they catch you throwing down a little bit of, you know, what you call bakos. I guess you call them bakos.
There are actually bakos are vegan, believe it or not.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
that should be easy for me then.
There's a lot of things that are vegan, but you wouldn't know it. That's the other really cool thing.
Gene, I eat a bakos-based diet. I always have.
Now you can do this.
Have it on almost everything. But what I like about it is you take into account it's pragmatic.
Yeah.
You take into account that this is not an easy transition for people, that we have been raised on a certain thing. And there's a lot of things in here that talk about trying just to make small lifestyle changes that can still make a big difference.
Very true. And for example, spaghetti and meatballs. You can just do veggie meatballs.
Right.
Or put veggies in there. So that's an example of what you do instead of hamburgers,
right.
Veggie burgers.
Right.
Or you could also just eat beans and whole foods, you know, and veggies and fruits. And there's
or even you say, like, just do it once a week.
Once a week. Meatless Mondays is a great program.
Right. And Tofu Tuesday, for God's sake. We could do this all day.
We could.
What is the difficulty of this? Because you have the moral argument, that sort of this idea that these animals, we don't understand they're individuals.
They are, and they have emotional lives, they have relationships, and they want to live just like we do. They're not different than cats and dogs, right, in terms of their desire to be friends with us. And at Farm Sanctuary, and I think you've started experiencing this too, yeah, with animals, they get to know you and they start following you around. And we have turkeys at the farm who just love human companionship.
Right.
And that's something most people don't understand or recognize. And unfortunately, when these animals are being mistreated on factory farms and when we're eating them, really, there's sort of an emotional desire not to think about
them. But you have all these arguments against it. Do you feel the tide changing? It seems like it's changing.
In a huge way. There's more awareness now than there's ever been before. People recognize that the way we've been eating this country is really problematic. Mm-hmm. People are suffering from heart disease, cancer. People are recognizing that climate change is a major issue we need to look at. And we can make one choice to eat plant foods instead of animal foods, and it will have an impact. And it's something everybody can do. There's a lot of things in this world we don't have a lot of control over. But what we decide to eat, each of us every day has a choice to make. And
that's maybe the one thing that's difficult, people, is it would seem overwhelming. Like, do you have to cook? You know, the one thing that we've been able to do in this society is make things convenient. Yes. You can drive up and get just poison in a box.
It's what we got.
It's
poison
fast
in a box.
Will this lifestyle be able to compete, or will it ever be able to compete if it doesn't have that same kind of convenience? Or is that the next wave? Is that the next thing that's coming?
I think the convenience is coming. You right. have vegan fast food restaurants now that are being established around the country. Right. You have vegan meatless meats, vegan dairy products.
You got to come up with a better thing than meatless meats, because that just in terms of sloganeering, we got to do it. I'm a delicious meatless meat. Well, that's the next, I think.
And non-dairy milks, too. Like, you go to mainstream grocery stores, there's alternatives to cow's milk everywhere. So it's getting a lot easier.
Yeah, I'm a lactate man. I don't know what they can do for that. But that's, have I shared too much already with the audience? It's really a terrific book. It lays it out so simply and credibly, and then tons of great recipes. I really appreciate it. You guys are doing phenomenal work at Farm Sanctuary, and this book is great as well. So get it! Living the Farm Sanctuary Life.
Okay, and Captain Doug, will you fetch our sister Rainbird while I read a little bit from this epilogue on our fairy kingdom here? See if we can finish that part tonight. We got a little bit of a limit on our time, don't we? I just had to share as much as possible. There's so much to share. There's so many beautiful things. Cooperatives, everybody. Community. Let's take this whole situation in hand here. Dora Van Gelder Kuntz, our sister, is writing a little bit of an epilogue here on the real world of fairies. Okay, so I'll just say she decided to go revisit a few places about 15, 20 years after she had visited them in the first round. And the last sentence in the last paragraph that we read from yesterday was saying, "Of course, my visit occurred during the extreme cold of a hard winter." This was at the New York, a bay in New York that she used to go to the beach and visit. It was at extreme cold of a hard winter, and seasonal conditions have their own effect. Yet the fairies still feel that people have been responsible for the diminution of life forms. And so even the sea fairies are not so friendly to human beings. Even farther out in the deep water, there is now less life than before. The broken discontinuous pattern of energy is evident as far from the shore as I could see. This damage is due to a physical cause, so the fairies can only partially repair the damage. Since the symbiotic relationship between the sea and the air extending over the entire Earth is disrupted, there may be more far-reaching effects in the long run than I could ever detect in this one locale. The air fairies can escape the effects of pollution relatively easy by rising higher into the sky. Yet they are not happy either. There is a kind of pull in the energy pattern, even in the top layer of the air. The air fairies, too, are somewhat withdrawn from human beings and do not seem to be working effectively against pollution. Both air and sea fairies do not appear to enjoy having many people about. They are carrying on, of course, yet there is a difference. They feel they cannot handle, keep up with what we are doing. They feel that this is something they simply cannot adapt to, and they get discouraged. Apparently, these are responses more to air than to water pollution, for the deep water out at sea is still the least polluted of all. The deep ocean rejuvenates. I do not want to mislead you. The fairies are still beautiful. And the fairies, they still very much are themselves. And there is still a wonderful cleansing quality to the sea. We just have, unfortunately, made some dramatic differences to that situation, but yet the power of our focus with the knowingness of who we are can literally, by applying love, can transmute that too. Indeed, we are learning many things about who we are. The angels, being so much higher, are somewhat removed from the pollution, yet deeply affected by its consequences. The angels are more resigned to the effects of pollution than are the fairies. They feel that in the long run, humans will do something to remedy the condition, yet that there is a dangerous period to go through, a period of great stress, which is evidenced by a tremendous pressure in the inner worlds. And of course, divas, as a whole, have a longer range view than do the fairies, who work for harmony from day to day. This period of stress and lack of coherence and energy patterns is already evident from the breaks near shore of the symbiotic network that I mentioned. Pollution on the sound is sometimes very thick, and during these times of pollution alert, it seems as though there is a sort of string of, for lack of a better word, dense energy, which unsettles the reciprocal relationship between earth, air, and water. The fairies and water babies, they try to do something to offset this effect, yet at present they are rather nonpulsed and don't seem to know what they can do. The divas, being farther from it and seeing things from a larger view, they feel that it will be overcome. We shall overcome, and seemingly await for the humans to repair their own damage. I'm going to stop right there. We'll do some more next week. I'm just going to say that's a wonderful thing to say. And let it begin with me now. Our sister Lynn on the break there, when we run our conference line, she said they already have a piece of technology in Japan that is clearing the plastic in the ocean. And I thought, oh my goodness, we'll have to look for that. Okay, sisters, this and brothers, this talking stick has had a long day. And for it to get its rejuvenation, I need to pass it on to my sister Rainbird. That crystal clear kind of rain that you get in the Himalayas of the West, where our sister lives, with all kinds of fairies and angels and dragons too. And so to everyone, I pass this talking to you, Sister Rainbird, to take us through our transition into the night work. And here it comes. It's got lots of fairies and their dust with them. Emerald serpent feathered talking stick, to you it goes. Here we come. Whoops. Rainbird, I can't hear you. Uh-oh. I heard some clicking. That's good for starters. I hear the clicking. We need the whole girl and her voice. I still just hear clicking, like little click clicks, like something's working, but not all the way. Huh. Commander Doug, do you think if you call Rainbird back, you can get her on the horn better? Yeah, but she's having trouble being able to... Oops, there she goes. Okay, let's try that again. Thank you. See if you can get her on the horn there so that we can hear her. Okay, Rainbird. Well, where art thou? Oh, just clicking. Oh. No? I don't know what... Okay. That sounds... Rainbird, are you there? Yeah, you can't do anything out on your end. I know this was a troublesome thing that happened the last time we talked to her at the beginning. It's still happening. I don't know. She's trying. I think she's trying. Yeah. Rainbird just got a new headset not too long ago. How could that be? Oh, dear. Well, you mean we should be. Are you talking to us, Don? Doug? Oh, Rainbird. Oh, I don't know if Rainbird. Rainbird, are you hearing? Go to tools. I don't think it's her speakers on her internet. It's her headset that I think it is on the phone. We might have to just let this go because of the timing, because it's really late. Rainbird, we got to take you in spirit, I think. I don't know what this is. Okay. All right, everybody. In the spirit of the time that we're in, let's let the spirit of our roomie give us our wisdom for the evening tonight. We love everybody. Let's go there. Send a lots of love and healing for that headset. Let's see if we can figure that out down the road here. Okay, this is called What is Real Love? And this is part three. We did part one and two last week. So here goes to part three. A Sufi person.
We were being given spiritual power. That's through that spiritual power you can see, you can hear what people cannot see, what people cannot hear, for some certain spiritual healers. that they can feel that energy moving, and they can decode it, and they can see the hearts of the people, what they need, and they give to everyone what she or he needs to his heart or to her heart. That's why it is mentioned and it is said that mysticism or Sufism or love, real love, is to tolerate and to accept. If someone harming you, tolerate that person and accept that harm, means accept to carry that difficulty and make that person pure, clean. That is our job. That's why messengers and prophets and saints came. They came only to carry our difficulties and make us to feel happy. So our duty is to carry difficulties and make others to be happy. These are the keys to the divine. People are looking for reality. Buddha was looking for reality. He left his kingdom. He left his sultanate. He left his father's kingdom. He was king and went into the jungle. He went into this world looking for reality, for enlightenment. Similarly, in every religion, there are people looking for to find realities. And these realities cannot be found easily. You have to give up what you love. If you keep what you love in your heart and in yourself, for yourself, and not share it with others, then you cannot find enlightenment. Enlightenment only can be given when you give what you own. And what you own, you give it to others, sharing with them. There are people they are not giving from what they have been given. What we have been given is this health that we are breathing, and we are hearing, and we are seeing, and we are feeling, and we are teaching. From that, we have to give to everyone in order that we will be successful in our lives. May let us pray, all of us together, in this blessed night, that this enlightenment will be open on us. That where your center of understanding and learning, the center of that receiving that enlightenment, is on top of our heads, where it will be like a satellite receiving that energy. And when the energy comes, we can channel it to everyone else, like that energy being channeled now in these lamps. Same energy give lights, this one give sound, this one give picture, that one gives different cooling, air conditioning or heating, but it is the same energy. All of us, we have that energy coming to us. But if you use the right instrument, then you can see, you can hear, you can feel, you can sense, you can heal from far distance. And that's why healers are able to heal. Today, there is a big advance in studying spirituality in major universities around the world. One of them is Harvard University. They are studying. They have created a faculty called Mind, Body, and Spirit. and they are trying to understand how this healing process works. I was part of that faculty one time, and I gave speeches on that issue. And from a religious perspective or spiritual perspective, how you can heal from far away, and I don't want to enter into this subject, but I would like to say that the statistics that has been found through, that has been done on different patients, real patients, that they have different sicknesses, that the mantra or the ritual or the prayings that has been prayed on them or recited on them or singing on them, it affected them by healing them. Although they were not in direct contact with the healer was somewhere and the patient was somewhere else. With that concentration and focusing that energy, like you are focusing it so much that it becomes very sharp, like laser. When you focus the light of that laser and make it so sharp, it can heal. And that's why they are healing a lot of sickness through lasers now. So when you focus your energy and make it so concentrated, you can reach any person around the globe that's seeking for help, and you can help. This is the cream of that study that has been done in Harvard University. Until today, they are still more studying into this research. What I want to say is that healers, they reach that kind of power or enlightenment by tolerating and accepting everyone else. Not only tolerating, and that's what I want to emphasize, is spirituality is to tolerate and accept. I accept the child, I accept the teenager, I accept the adult, I accept the elderly man or woman, and tolerate them and accept them and give them more of my what I have, not to give myself, but to give them, because then I will be getting more. When you give, you get. When you are stingy, you don't get anything. Already, it's enough what is in your hand. They keep it like that with you full, but if you open it, more comes to you and to the others. May God forgive us and bless us. أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله أستغفر الله 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 العظيم الذي لا إله إلا هو الحي القيوم وأتوب إليه إنه هو التواب الرحيم.
Okay, the humbleness of a Sufi master. We indeed got that one. Okay, so we're going to go from Sufi mystic master to our white blonde Nordic goddesses. That's right. Okay, this one we'll do. How about that one? It is a delight to the heart, to the eyes, and to the beauty that they're in. This was in a gorgeous forest with a little bridge going over the brook. And, oh, my God, there's four of them, and they are just, you can hardly believe what you're looking at. Please go check these ones out. All right, everybody. Until we meet again, let it be tomorrow and Monday with our sister. You know that number? 605-475-5950. 605-475-5950. And we meet again at 9:15 Eastern Time, 6:15 Pacific Time. And we'll spend some time with this kind of energy and calling it in across the planet. We have that power, and when two or more are gathered, it is exponential, and it can change the world, and indeed, that's the only thing that ever has. With that, I leave you, and I'll see you on the bridge, and we shall dance this dream fully awake now. This Sarah now, peace to all, and to all a good night. Inshallah and Sat Nam.
Sat Nam Ji.